Okay, good morning, everybody. My name is Bill Yates. Actually, today I'm the all-powerful Oz behind the iPhone. I would like to start up the Tahoe Regional Plan Implementation Committee meeting, and this will be via GoToWebinar. And the first item of business really is to, Tracy, if you would call the roll to assure a quorum of the members.
Ms. Oldeen?
Here.
Mr. Bruce?
Hey, good morning. This is Jim Lawrence. I just got off the phone with Mark. He's having trouble logging in, so he's going to keep trying and perhaps go to the phone. But he will be joining as soon as he can.
Thank you. Ms. Gustafson?
I'm here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
And Mr. Yates?
Here. That's it for us? Okay. Yeah, we had quite a storm blow through Sacramento County. I don't know what it was like in Placer, Cindy, but I'm along with about 35,000 other people in Arden Arcade without power. And hopefully my battery on my iPhone will last. It's interesting that no matter what goes on, Mother Nature seems to rise up and let you know that, in fact, she still does bat last. The next item on the agenda is approval of the agenda. John Hester, are there any changes in the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, there are no changes.
Thank you. I'll approve the agenda as sent out in our packet. And the next item, which we have a set of minutes to approve. Does anybody have any comments on the minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the minutes from the RPIC meeting of December 16th, 2020 as presented.
Thank you very much, Shelley. Any other comments from colleagues? Hearing none, I guess we'll just do a nice voice vote on this. All in favor of approval of the amendment?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Also, for this meeting, I think we invited John Friedrich to attend this meeting. He will be added to the committee later today in the governing board meeting, but I wanted John to be able to attend if he could. And John, are you on the call?
Yes, I am.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us. You'll find this is going to be quite a hearing. I appreciate you being on.
Yep, you bet.
So the first item I have is an informational presentation on Meeks Bay Restoration Project and Environmental Alternatives, which is at page 327 of the governing board packet. And so staff, who is going to take over on this project?
That would be me. Good morning, everyone. I'm Rebecca Kermine, a planner at TRPA, and I'm here to present on the Meeks Bay project.
So thank you, Rebecca.
We can go ahead and get started into the next slide. So today's presentation is an update on the Meeks Bay Restoration Project and proposed alternatives. Oh, it's the first slide. Anyway, I can go back. We last presented this item to the full governing board in fall of 2018 when the Forest Service scoped the project. During that scoping period, the Forest Service did receive a number of comments and concerns about the proposed action. And given that high level of interest and importance of this restoration opportunity, the Forest Service took a step back to focus on public engagement prior to beginning the environmental analysis. And to that end, the Forest Service and TRPA entered into a cooperative agreement whereby TRPA would manage the environmental and the facilitation contract. So over the last year, the planning team worked with a stakeholder group and conducted public workshops to develop a range of project alternatives. So today's presentation is largely focused on these alternatives. We have Adam Lewandowski with Ascent Environmental here to lead that portion of the presentation. We also have Stephanie Heller with the Forest Service, who will go over the purpose and need for the project. Next slide. So the project will be analyzed under a joint triple environmental document, as we do in Tahoe, with the Forest Service as the land manager and the NEPA lead. TRPA will be acting as the contract manager for the environmental analysis and the public engagement, as well as ensuring the project meets TRPA thresholds. We also have Lahontan Water Board as the CEQA lead. Next slide. So this is just an overview of the timeline for the environmental document. So where we are today is at the end of the project development of the alternatives. And that's why we're here today, to get your feedback on that. Our next phase is really working, diving into that environmental document, which we anticipate to have out for public review this fall, and then taking the project for final consideration in the spring of 2020. Okay, and so with that, I will pass the presentation on to Stephanie Heller, who will go over the project purpose and need. Hopefully she's on. I think she is.
Stephanie, can you hear us?
639. We aren't receiving your number entry due to a possible issue.
Hello,
with your
can you hear
carrier.
Me?
Please hang up and dial another provided phone number, or try dialing from.
We hear you, Stephanie.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Stephanie, we can hear you.
We can hear you, Stephanie. Yeah.
Hey, Bill Yates. This is Mark Bruce. I'm on.
I can cover those slides if you can't get on.
Maybe we should have someone fill in for Stephanie if she's having difficulty.
Okay, we can go ahead. So we'll go ahead. Yeah. We have to adapt here, right? Okay.
Today seems to be that kind of a day.
Okay, so I'll briefly go over the project purpose and need. So really the purpose of this project is to move the Meeks Creek stream channel and the wetland lagoon below State Route 89 to a more natural condition. And that's really to restore that stream to a functioning ecosystem, you know, prior to the way it was before it was dredged for marina. So on this slide here, you can see a 1950s photo of Meeks Bay and the stream before it was dredged. And then to the right is a more recent photo of 2003 with the marina in that stream channel. Next slide. So this is a project area outline. So you can see this whole area is managed by the Forest Service, and we have the Forest Service has a couple of concessions contracts here. In the north of Meeks, the north side of the creek, we have the Meeks Bay Resort, which is operated by the Washoe Tribe. And then to the south, you have California Land Management, camping area, and day use. And then the project area extends a little bit into the meadow above the 89 bridge. Next slide.
Hey, Rebecca, can you hear me?
Yeah, Stephanie's here. Yeah.
All right. Sorry about that. My audio just dropped as you tried to turn over to me. So I'll continue. Thanks.
Oh, great. Thank you. Perfect timing.
All right. So the need for the project. See, Rebecca just went over the project area. So I'll start with the need. So first, there is a need to improve hydrologic function within the creek and lagoon and floodplain. In the current condition, the stream below Highway 89 is deeply incised and eroding. The lagoon has been altered into a highly unnatural configuration with dredging of the marina. There is a need to restore the degraded aquatic riparian and wetland habitats and barrier beaches to provide high quality habitat that is resilient to climate change. As in the current degraded condition, it's very vulnerable to any changes in hydrologic regime. There is a need to promote threatened, endangered, proposed, candidate, and sensitive species. These include Tahu yellowcrest, which is currently found near the mouth of Meeks Creek, and Lahontan cutthroat trout, which was historically present in the watershed. Next slide. Right. There is a need to improve fish passage through the SR 89 stream crossing and control or eradicate current populations of terrestrial and aquatic invasive plant and animal species. The current marina configuration is very friendly to aquatic invasive. The Forest Service is currently undergoing a project to remove Eurasian milfoil from the marina, which has been an ongoing multi-year project. And then there are other warm water invasive fish species that make it into this area. There's a need to replace the Caltrans bridge to allow for aquatic organism passage. Without the organism passage under the highway, the stream ecosystem will not be fully functional. Also, passage is a key component to native species restoration. Next slide. Right. There is a need to enhance access to Lake Tahoe and National Forest Service lands, as this is a part of the primary mission of the Forest Service. There is a need to provide sustainable recreation opportunities consistent with functioning ecosystems. As stated previously, this area has a long history as a recreation site, and it is important to continue to provide that benefit to the public. There is a need to enhance educational and interpretive opportunities. This area has a rich cultural history in addition to the ecological importance of the stream lagoon, and conveying that information to the public can be important to the management and enjoyment of the area. There is a need to enhance species of value of the Washoe tribe. The Meeks Creek watershed is an important area to the tribe. They work in conjunction with the Forest Service to manage and cultivate culturally significant species in Meeks Meadow just upstream of the project. And the tribe is also the current manager of Meeks Bay Resort. And now I'd like to turn it over to Adam Lewandowski, who will be describing the planning framework and public engagement.
I'm Adam Lewandowski with Ascend Environmental, and I'll talk about the collaborative planning process that was used to develop the alternatives, and I'll also go through the various project elements that are under consideration. Next slide, please. So the planning process really began with the environmental scoping back in 2018, and at that time, the Forest Service released a preliminary proposed action and sought public comments. That preliminary proposed action was really an initial proposal for the restoration project. It included full restoration of the creek and the lagoon, and it recognized that the restoration of the lagoon would require the permanent removal of the marina. To offset the loss of motorized boat access from the marina, the preliminary proposed action included a proposed pier and boat ramp at the south end of Meeks Bay. During the scoping period, the Forest Service received a lot of public comments. Many of those comments opposed the proposed pier and boat ramp, citing concerns about safety and recreation impacts of introducing motorized boat launching into what's existing swimming area. And there are also concerns about traffic, noise, and dedicating recreational land to boat trailer parking. Most of the comments supported the restoration, but some comments advocated for keeping the marina and noted that it was an important recreation resource. So to better understand the different viewpoints and concerns and to identify some potential solutions, the project team then conducted a stakeholder assessment. We brought in the Consensus Building Institute as a neutral third-party mediator and facilitator, and they interviewed many nearby residents, organizations and agencies with a connection to Meeks Bay, and other people that commented during the scoping period. We then established a stakeholder forum, which includes a representative group of stakeholders with different interests in Meeks Bay and different viewpoints. This stakeholder forum met in four half-day virtual meetings that were all open to the public. And one of the roles of the stakeholder forum was to make sure that all of the relevant issues and concerns were considered in the development of the alternatives. as well as to engage in productive dialogue about the best possible alternative designs. We also gathered public input at two virtual public workshops where participants took surveys, provided comments, and participated in small group discussions. Next slide. So all of this input was considered through an iterative design process, working closely with stakeholders to develop the alternatives. And essentially, the alternatives are an attempt to balance the issues and considerations that were brought up in the public comments, the detailed input that was received through the stakeholder forum meetings, as well as the alternative feasibility. We wanted to make sure that all of the proposed features and approaches are realistic and feasible. And they also consider whether the proposed alternatives and alternative features would meet the purpose and need of the project and allow for the restoration of Meeks Creek. So through this process, the project team decided to no longer pursue the original proposed action as it was released back in 2018. And instead, we've developed four alternatives that we propose to evaluate through the environmental review process. Next slide. So the first alternative I'd like to discuss is the no action alternative. This is essentially the status quo. It represents what would happen if the project is not approved. And this no action alternative will be evaluated in the environmental review and it'll be treated the same as all of the action alternatives. So this diagram shows the conditions at Meeks Bay today, which would continue under the no action alternative. So there are about 76 campsites right now between the north and the south campgrounds, which are shown in green. You can see the existing marina with a boat ramp near the center that hasn't been operational for several years. But it does include capacity for approximately 120 slips. You can see the parking areas in kind of the gray-brown color and day use areas in orange. And then there's the West Shore Bike Trail shown as that brown line, which comes in from the north and ends at Meeks Bay today. So with this alternative, with a no-action alternative, there would be no restoration. The marina would remain and it could be operational based on lake level. So when the lake level is low, it would be closed just as it always has been. But when the lake level is high enough, it could be open. There would be water quality BMP installation around parking areas and other facilities. But other than that, there'd be no changes to the upland facilities. Next slide. So that's the no action alternative. We also developed three action alternatives. And there are a number of features that were either included in that original proposed action or that came up through the alternative development process that really made sense to include in all of the action alternatives. So all three of the action alternatives will include the elements you see on the screen. They'll all have the full restoration of the creek and the lagoon. They'll include shoreline stabilization and replacement of some deteriorating rock gabions. They'll include reconfigured parking and circulation, aquatic invasive species control, water quality best management practices, and they'll all include the replacement of that Highway 89 bridge to improve fish passage. Next slide. All of the alternatives will also include an interpretive trail near the restored lagoon, as well as other interpretive features. They'll all include utility infrastructure relocation that's necessary to allow for the restoration. As well as the removal of the marina infrastructure and the boat ramp. They would all include on-site paddlecraft storage, as well as a bike path along the highway, as well as a spur path that would go into Meeks Bay itself to provide some connected, bike trail connectivity through the project area. Next slide. So the major differences between the action alternatives are summarized on page 331 of your packet, but the key differences really relate to whether there is a pier and how that pier is designed, as well as the size and configuration of campgrounds, parking areas, and day use areas. So this diagram shows proposed alternative one. This alternative would include the removal of the marina and the full restoration of the creek, and it would include a boating pier on the north side of the creek, near where a historic pier used to be located decades ago. That pier would allow for boats to access Meeks Bay from elsewhere on the lake and to tie up temporarily and access the shore at Meeks Bay, but it would not allow motorized boat launching from Meeks Bay. To reach a navigable water depth, even during low lake conditions, this pier would need to be about 300 feet long. And the pier would include one boat lift that could be used to store a firefighting boat. And this could help to improve emergency response capabilities by providing a fireboat on this portion of the lake. This alternative would not change the number of campsites, but it would separate the RV sites from the tent sites, with dedicated RV camping on the north and tent camping on the south. It would reconfigure the campsites to provide more privacy and better access where possible. And it would also reconfigure and expand the day use area near the pier on the north side, as well as on the south side. On the north end of Meeks Bay, this alternative would include the removal of one of the existing motel style cabin units that's right on the lake. And it would replace that with several standalone cabins set further back from the beach. And this would allow for expanding the area of natural beach for recreational use. This alternative would also include the connected bike paths. You can see as the brown lines on the screen along the highway and then through Meeks Bay. It would include those interpretive features, paddlecraft storage, and all of those other features that are common to all of the alternatives. Next slide. So alternative two would also include the same full restoration of the creek and lagoon. It would include a pedestrian pier in the same location as the boating pier was proposed in alternative one. So this would be a smaller pier that would be universally accessible, and it would allow people to get out on the lake, but it would not allow, it would not be accessed by motorized boats. So it could be shorter than the boating pier at around 100 feet instead of the 300 feet for the boating pier in alternative one. And it could be designed as either a floating pier or a traditional pier design. Like alternative one, this alternative would reconfigure the campgrounds with no change in the number of campsites. It would reconfigure and expand the day use areas, and it would include the connected bike paths, the interpretive features, the paddlecraft storage, and all of those other features common to all alternatives. Next slide. So the final alternative is shown here as alternative three. Again, this includes the same full restoration of the creek and lagoon. This alternative would include no pier. But it would have a small paddlecraft launch structure on the south end. And this would be an accessible structure that would allow for kayak and paddleboard launches, but not for motorized boat access. This alternative would reconfigure the campgrounds and expand them by adding a total of 20 campsites, with 10 on the north and 10 on the south side, within a larger campground footprint. It would also reconfigure the parking on the south side, and it would move the parking closer to the highway, as you can see in the bottom left corner of the diagram, and it would have a drop-off area closer to the beach. And this parking design is intended to provide more direct access between the campground and the beach and the day-use areas, and also to buffer the campground from the road noise by providing a little bit of space between the highway and the campground. Like alternatives one and two, this would also reconfigure and expand the day-use areas, include connected bike paths, bridge replacement, interpretive features, and all of those other elements. Next slide. So these are just some representative photos of the paddlecraft storage and the launch structures. And the exact design for these features hasn't been determined, but the paddlecraft launch is included in alternative three. And that would be a small structure that would provide accessible launching opportunity for paddlecraft. And it would be somewhat similar to the structures you see on the bottom photos. And of course, people could still launch their kayaks and stand up paddleboards from anywhere on the beach. The paddlecraft storage feature is proposed as part of all of the action alternatives. And this would be a place where private individuals could lock up and store their kayaks or stand up paddleboards on site, similar to what's shown on the photos in the top. And this is really intended to make it more convenient for paddlers, and it may allow some people to walk, bike, or take transit to Meeks because they wouldn't need to haul their paddlecraft with them each time. Next slide. So those are the proposed alternatives, but there are also several suggestions that came up through the alternatives development process that were considered but ultimately were not incorporated into an alternative. The project team and the stakeholders recognized that the existing marina is an important recreational resource for those individuals that moor their boats there. So much of the time in the stakeholder forum meetings and throughout the design process was focused on trying to figure out a way to continue to provide motorized boat mooring or launching opportunities at Meeks Bay, while also restoring the lagoon and preserving the high quality beach recreation and camping opportunities. Through the planning process, we considered a variety of options for boat ramps, buoys, marinas, and the most viable of these options was the concept shown on the screen. That would have included a smaller restoration project with a smaller marina separated from the restored lagoon. We took a close look at whether this concept would be feasible, but it was not carried forward into one of the alternatives because even a small marina would really reduce the effectiveness of the restoration project. And creating a small marina in this location would involve a substantial cost to construct, operate, and maintain the facility. And at the most, it would accommodate 20 to 40 boats. So it would be for the benefit of a small number of people. And in the end, the costs and the impacts of creating a small marina would outweigh the benefits. And it wouldn't be something that the Forest Service would realistically build or operate. And it wouldn't be consistent with the project's purpose and need. So we do realize that some people would like to see motorized boating or boat mooring at Meeks Bay, but after careful consideration, these facilities just aren't feasible or consistent with the purpose and need of the project, so they're not proposed to be carried forward in the action alternatives. However, the no action alternative is a viable option, and that will be treated the same as the action alternatives in the environmental review, and that would maintain the existing marina. Next slide. So I also just wanted to acknowledge that there are several related plans that you're all familiar with that would affect the project. And the alternatives have been developed to be consistent with the recently adopted shoreline plan, which regulates piers and other facilities, as well as the State Route 89 corridor plan, which includes a vision for transportation and access along the project area, and the Lake Tahoe West Restoration Initiative, which includes a strategy for large landscape restoration along the West Shore. Next slide. And this project would also complement the Myala Wata Meadow Restoration Project. And that's being implemented by the Washoe Tribe and the Forest Service and is located directly upstream of the Meeks Bay Restoration Project on the meadow on the west side of the highway. Next slide. I also just wanted to mention that we do have a project website, meeksbayproject.org. And on that, you can find lots of background information, as well as video recordings from the public workshops, summaries and materials from all the stakeholder forum meetings, and a lot of other background information. Next slide. So that's the end of our presentation. So we'd like to open it up for questions and comments. And Rebecca, Stephanie, and I are all available to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Adam. Well done. So are there any questions from any of the committee members? Unfortunately, I don't have chat and I don't have hand raising, so you're just going to have to kind of speak up when you feel like you want to ask a question. I apologize for this problem, but it's out of my control.
Mr. Chair, this is Jim Lawrence. I have a question, if I may.
Sure, Jim. Go ahead.
Thank you. And thank you, Adam, Rebecca, and Stephanie. I really appreciate the presentation. Very, very helpful. Adam, you mentioned, you know, at the end of the presentation, you know, pointing to documents like the shoreline plan and the 89 corridor plan, that this is consistent with it. When I was reading through the board packet, I was looking for more information on just how this project ties into the Highway 89 corridor plan, maybe which alternatives maybe more conducive or not conducive. I'm curious, and the reason why I'm asking is, you know, we're finding on the east shore at Sand Harbor that with the growth in recreation in that area, we're having to reconfigure our entrance in order to accommodate shuttles coming in. So I'm curious, with these alternative designs and the different parking, which ones are more conducive or not, or how are they designed to accommodate the Highway 89 corridor plan?
I can take this if you want, Adam. we've been coordinating with the 89 planning team on this for sure. And the various designs of the bike trail, I think, will ultimately have to, you know, they're going to connect with the West Shore Trail that's being designed right now. Actually, there's a feasibility study going on right now. So we're coordinating with that team to make sure that, you know, the Meeks Bay alignment will connect with that. And then also some of the parking reconfiguration on the site will help alleviate some of the congestion that's on that roadway right now. So that will help with the situation ultimately. I don't know if the Forest Service has anything else to add on that.
Thanks, Rebecca. How about like traffic circulation? I appreciate with the bike paths, but if we have a, you know, maybe a shuttle system, like we're trying to get going on the Highway 28 corridor. Again, we've had challenges with drive-in traffic at Sand Harbor and trying to get the buses in. So we're having to rethink Sand Harbor as far as traffic circulation goes. And that's really what I'm the most curious about with the parking lot designs. Does it envision like shuttle systems coming in if there's park and ride spots at either end of the Highway 89 corridor? I'm just curious on the thought process or your work with the corridor team, or maybe it's decided that it's not necessary or relevant. But I do think traffic circulation is going to be critical, particularly as recreation demand continues to increase.
Yeah, I know that there's some traffic stops, some transit stops planned right at Meeks Bay, but maybe Adam can answer the question about the design of the circulation because he's working with the design team on this.
Yeah, and so far there haven't been any issues identified with the, you know, the existing entrances off of the highway that would, you know, be a concern for transit. The internal circulation within the, you know, the project area is being designed to accommodate buses and, you know, as well as RVs and the whole range of vehicles we expect out there. The other, you know, as Rebecca mentioned, the other big relationship to the SR 89 corridor is obviously the bike path and then the parking. And I did want to note that for the most part, alternatives one and two maintain about the same parking capacity on site, but it's reconfigured and should be, you know, better use of space. Alternative three does increase the parking capacity, I believe by about 14 parking spaces. And so that would potentially alleviate a little bit of the roadside parking that's an issue along.
Okay, thank you. It's helpful, thanks.
Hey Jim, this is John Marshall. I just want to say, I think your comments are well taken in terms of designing, you know, making sure that the design of the eventual selected alternative and whether or not when the alternatives are analyzed, that the that the likely increase in shuttle activity be taken into account. So those are great comments.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, this is Cindy Gustaf.
Hi, Cindy. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Bill. Tough to do on the phone, huh?
it is.
Is relevant to the pier, Adam. And in alternative one, we show the pier with the fireboat access. Was there any discussion following up on Jim's concerns on transit, wheeled transit? Off and on through the years, we've talked about waterborne transit and obviously getting people around the lake and making sure that people can get to the lake in multi-modes. Alternative one would allow for that. It didn't appear that alternative two was set up for that. Is that correct?
With the that comment has come up through the public workshops and the stakeholder forum meetings. And you know, this project doesn't propose any kind of transit or facilities that are specifically designed for water transit. But you're correct that the pier in alternative one, is out to is a big enough pier out to big enough water that it would accommodate some future transit connection or water taxi service or whatever form that takes. And you're right, the alternative two would strictly be a recreational pedestrian pier, and it wouldn't go far enough out into the water to really accommodate water transit of any kind.
Yeah, I know that there's, you know, the transit, the shuttle, the waterborne transit shuttle that was used was very small and it allowed people to bring bikes and I think it seated eight individuals. So we're not talking San Francisco style ferries, but looking at smaller watercraft, and along with obviously the fire and our emergency response boat would be great on in that area of the lake. So I wanted to support that. Also agree with Jim's comments. I'm making sure we're designing this to consider getting people out of their vehicles and you know, making this blend into our corridor plans and our overall RTP, regional transportation plan, so that we have as much mobility thought of now as it changes. I know we can't always anticipate every change in mobility, but making sure we have all those options thoroughly vetted. But otherwise, I think the alternatives, especially alternative one, look really, really good.
Oops, sorry, I didn't unmute myself. Any other comments from my colleagues? Okay, well, I just have one comment, Adam, and this seems to be the typical kind of federal environmental review where you put out three action, but at what point does the Forest Service select the project? I mean, that would help. I would think Cindy and Jim, when you really have a sense of what is the one that the applicant really is going to propose as the project, and that changes how you compare some of the alternatives. I mean, we have three fairly nice alternatives, but until one is really selected, I'm not sure which is the real project.
So the Forest Service, I think where this comes up from is CEQA selects a preferred alternative. The federal NEPA does not select a preferred alternative. We analyze all the alternatives equally. And then in the end, our decision maker, which is our forest supervisor, chooses the alternative that is the action. And I think it's also maybe important to note here, sorry I missed a little bit, I don't know if it was mentioned at the beginning, but we are also not necessarily beholden to accept any of these alternatives as a standalone action, which I'm sure probably makes this much more confusing and gets even farther away from what you're asking for. But we could, in some sense, mix and match alternatives in our final decision.
Okay, so there would be subsequent environmental review after the Forest Service selects the alternative. In the final environmental impact statement, there would be that analysis of that project. At least that's my understanding of NEPA. I'm just trying to figure out how we would. I mean, there's like so many things at Tahoe right now in our transportation issues, and especially with the experience that Jim has had on the east side, trying to figure out how best to accommodate the traffic and how we better design the circulation going into and out of these popular areas. And then also there's pieces of this, as you said, which you could mix and match in the three alternatives. And then, of course, there is the desire, and I think also Cindy's likes the fact that it's going to provide opportunity for the fireboat. But at the same time, there are those that prefer a non-motorized experience, so that's always a challenge. I'm just trying to figure out as we proceed what we're going to see at the end here for TRPA to make its decision.
And I could just add that I think the desire really was to use the environmental analysis to help, you know, inform that selection of alternatives. As you're probably familiar with, there is a fairly recent CEQA case law that does require that a preferred alternative or proposed project be selected before the draft EIR is released. So our plan right now is to go through as much of the as we can on all three of the alternatives, keeping them at an equal level, and then using that environmental analysis to select a preferred alternative, at least for the purposes of CEQA, that would then be identified before the draft environmental comes out. And of course, as Stephanie mentioned, then there's the ability to refine that in response to comments or to mix and match elements from the various alternatives to get to the project that's ultimately going to be before you with the final environmental document.
Okay, thanks, Adam. That does help explain things. Thank you.
Bill, this is Shelley.
Hi, Shelley.
Well, in view of that, I'm going to weigh in and throw my support behind the preferred alternative. You know, I understand there are people who want to enjoy, you know, areas like Migs Bay without noise and interruption from boats. But I mean, there is an existing marina there right now. So boats are part of the equation, but eliminating the marina obviously has environmental benefits. So I think a nice compromise is to install this 300-foot length pier, which will enable people who are boaters, motorized boaters, to also enjoy the facility. So I think it's a very well-balanced alternative. It's difficult to strike, you know, something that is, or come up with something that's harmonious and addresses everyone's concerns and needs and desires. But I agree with Cindy. I think the preferred alternative, from my perspective, not only addresses the environmental needs, but addresses a variety of recreational demands. And so personally, I support the preferred alternative for that reason.
Thank you, Shelley.
Yeah, just a reminder, Shelley, that we actually have not selected a preferred alternative yet. That alternative one is, you know, equal to the alternative two and three. So the alternative one is the one with the pier.
Well, maybe I'm being a little presumptuous, Rebecca. I think that seems to be, based on my reading in the material, it seems to be the one that has garnered the most interest and support. And maybe that's not a valid observation, but I'll correct my use of the term preferred alternative. Number one is my preferred alternative. How about that?
That's good. And so maybe in the spring of 2022, all this will be out, and that might be the one that the Forest Service is going to propose. So anything else from anybody else? Well, I think I really appreciate that presentation. It was very thorough. And I really appreciate the work on the restoration of that lagoon. Also, I really was heartened by the fact that the involvement of the tribe in that meadow work and also just in this management of this area. I think that's great. That seems to have many wonderful things about it. But I think I'm ready to move on to the next item.
Bill, did you want to have public comment?
I have public comment, you're right. I do need a cheat sheet. Yeah, you're right. So let me open this up to public comment now. We've had plenty of member comments, but any public comments on the Migs Bay proposal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Catherine Hanglin with TRPA for the record. We have several hands raised to make public comment. Bill Lyons can go ahead and address the RPIC.
Yes, commissioners, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Mr. Lyons,
okay,
and
great,
I'm sorry to
great.
cut off public comment. It's just my error, so please proceed.
No. I appreciate that. Just quickly, my name is Bill Lyons. I'm the president of the Migs Bay Vista Property Owners Association, which represents approximately 100 property owners in the Migs Bay and Rubicon Bay area. We've been very active in the process. We live there, we're major stakeholders, and we've both been active both verbally and have submitted some comments. Please refer to the CBI interviewee list. We actually had four or five participants on that list. As the families and property owners who actually live there, we strongly lean towards alternative number three. Our initial comment on alternative number three would be to try to move the pedestrian pier to the north, which maybe could serve as an emergency pier also. We do support the restoration of Meeks Lagoon, Meeks Creek. We support to upgrade the utilities. But when we look at alternative three, it expands Meeks Bay's day use from 76 to 90. It increases parking spaces, increases campsites. We look at the pier that's being proposed as just absolutely destroying the unique Meeks Bay experience. I would urge the commissioners to actually go there on a July 4th weekend when the bay is completely filled with family-oriented activities, paddle boats, all kinds of different things going on. We don't believe that a motorized boat launch really serves the local community or the uniqueness of Meeks Bay. If you look at the CBI report, almost entirely stakeholder comments are against a motorized pier there. We think it's a paddler's oasis. We think it's a safe, sandy, friendly beach, family friendly again, and we don't want that disrupted. We think there's going to be issues with noise, pollution, the visual impact. It's one of the most unique places on the lake where you have an unimpaired look across a lake without boats and buoys out there disrupting it. We'd like, again, to urge the commissioners to consider alternative number three based on the input that they've got from a majority of the people that CBI interviewed. One of the questions my members are asking.
Mr. Lyons, your 3 minutes is up, and I appreciate what you're saying. And if you have additional comments, please send them, submit them to staff.
Well, my timer here said I had a little more time, but we would like to have you consider that, and we would encourage you to hold meetings during the summer or late spring so people could attend who actually use Meeks Bay. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Bill, I have one more question for staff, if you don't mind.
Sure, Sally. Go ahead.
I didn't, in my materials, Adam, I didn't see a reference in alternative one to a boat launch. I thought that was eliminated from alternative one. Is that not the case?
That's correct. There is no boat launch in alternative one, just the pier that people could access, you know, if they launch elsewhere on the lake.
Okay. And therefore, there's no need for trailer storage.
That's correct.
Mr. Lyons just happened to reference the boat launching, and I can understand, you know, how that could create a lot of traffic congestion and a lot of disruption, but just having people, day visitors, you know, park at the pier to enjoy Meeks Bay is entirely different than actually having an active launch site.
Catherine, any the next public comment, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Connie LaCroix. You can go ahead and address the RPIC. Connie, are you there?
She had to unmute.
No, she is unmuted. Connie, I will circle back to you.
Okay, great.
Bob Bolt, you are next up. Go ahead and unmute yourself to address the RPIC.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me make a comment. So my name is Bob Bolt, and I'm a board member of the Tahoe Lakefront Owners Association. But I am not speaking, certainly not speaking on behalf of the association today. These are my personal questions and comments. My question, it's really a question, personally, I'm strongly in favor of alternative one, but I might include some of the very nice features of alternative three in alternative one, the expansion of the campgrounds and other advantages, and perhaps the paddle boat launch area I would include in alternative one. The only reservation that I have about alternative one is I don't understand why the pier needed to be placed where it is, bisecting the beach. That would bring boats right into the middle of the beach area. And it seems to me, you know, the many years that I've been boating in Meeks Bay, that there could be a much better siting of a pier that would reduce some of the concerns. So that's number one. Number two, I think it's really important that we have Meeks Bay belongs to all of us, including boaters and paddlers and swimmers and sightseers. And I think the more avenues we have for allowing people to come into Meeks Bay and use it on a day basis, the better. And I'm hoping someday there will be water shuttles around the lake that will be friendly water shuttles, environmentally friendly water shuttles that will cut down some of the traffic on the roads. So I think it should be an objective to have as many transportation alternatives into Meeks Bay as possible by the largest number of people, including those who like to do it by boat. So I would ask that you take a look at the placement of the pier and to see if that can be a better place to make it more attractive to people who right now might be opposed to that alternative. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your comments. Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gavin Feiger, go ahead and address the RPIC.
Yes, hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, Gavin, go ahead.
Great, thank you. My internet's been a little slow this morning. Good morning, Gavin Feiger, League Disabled Lake Tahoe. Thanks for the opportunity to provide our support for this project today. As you know, the League is dedicated to protecting and restoring the environmental health, sustainability, and scenic beauty of the Lake Tahoe Basin. And in connection with our mission, we advocate for projects that restore meadows and marshes and the natural hydrologic function of Lake Tahoe's tributaries. Restoration helps prevent fine sediment, the leading cause of Lake Tahoe's dramatic clarity loss over the past half century, from entering Lake Tahoe, and also helps give the lake the tools to combat the impacts of our changing climate. We also advocate for stormwater improvement projects, sustainable shoreline planning, and control of aquatic invasive species, all elements of the proposed Meeks Bay Restoration Project. We've been involved with the development of this project since this process started in 2018 and before in preliminary discussions. We discussed the primary goals of the restoration project, which is restoration of the lagoon and Meeks Creek, including improved fish passage past the bridge, restoring the stream environment zones, controlling aquatic invasive species, and improving educational opportunities. So those are the main goals of the project. And the proposed action, most of these alternatives would achieve all these goals and restore the only beach barrier lagoon system in the Tahoe Basin. Alternative three represents a rare opportunity for a watershed scale environmental restoration at Tahoe, which is key to building ecosystem resilience to climate change. Throughout 2020, there was a stakeholder working group, which we were part of. We provided a lot of feedback. There were several public workshops, also a lot of great feedback and engagement. This is one of the better processes I've seen, especially during COVID. There really has been a lot of engagement, hundreds of people over this year or last year. We also support the focus on non-motorized use and the minimal impact to shoreline. The campground and day use enhancements and the bike and pedestrian trails and connectivity add to the environmental sustainability of the project, and the interpretive signage analyzing the alternatives across all alternatives will also be a big benefit. So alternative three currently appears to meet all of the project's goals and is able to provide those additional benefits, some of those upland benefits, without straying far beyond the scope of the project. And so far, based on feedback at the public meetings, the community seems to agree. If you look at those surveys, the consideration of a pier needs to be considered very carefully. The need for it, the costs and benefits, a 300-foot pier is a big thing to consider. and the marina has been closed for a few years now. So our hope is that this project can strike a balance between the types of uses, reduce the potential for user conflict on and off the water, and restore a functioning ecosystem and habitat. So big thanks to the Forest Service and project partners, TRPA in particular, and really hope that Alternative 3 and the non-motorized focus goes forward. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Gavin, for your comments. Catherine?
Yes, Anthony Evans. You are on mute if you unmute yourself to address the RPG.
Maybe the storm is picking these people off.
Yes, Anthony, you are still self-muted. If you unmute on your end. Oh, Anthony put his hand down. Okay. Jennifer Kwasnik, I've unmuted you and then you can go ahead and unmute yourself.
All right, thank you. Good morning. This is Jennifer Kwasnik and speaking on behalf of Friends of the West Shore. And first and foremost, you know, I want to say what some other commenters have said is this has been a very, you know, positive process, a lot of engagement with the public. We've been a participating stake member or stakeholder, and then also attended the public workshops, and staff and CBI put a lot of hard work into, you know, making sure that the public has had a chance to really comment on these things. And, you know, overwhelmingly, the public feedback from these workshops has been for non-motorized bay. We also surveyed our members, and Friends of the West Shore represents over 500 members and supporters, and they've been very engaged in this process and very interested. And the results of the survey indicate, again, an overwhelming support for a non-motorized situation at the bay. This is the only large, easily accessible sandy beach for the public between Tahoe City and Baldwin Beach, and we believe it should be treasured as such. It's a very unique opportunity to protect an area and really support the non-motorized uses along with the restoration. And in terms of some of the specifics, right now we favor Alternative 3 as well. That blends best with the feedback we've seen from our members, as well as majority of the public workshops. And I encourage everyone on this committee to go back and view the webinars from the public workshops and, you know, get a sense of what people have been doing here and how they feel about it. We do have a couple of comments, and I'll speak to one, and then I know Judy is the president's on this call. She'll speak as well. But one thing we have been looking at is the proposed non-motorized boat launch being on the South Beach. And one thing that's been clear throughout this process is that the, especially a lot of locals and people that come for day use, treasure the South Beach as a popular non-motorized recreation area. And so we're just concerned about having the non-motorized boat ramp there and, you know, putting more people in an area that's already pretty congested. And, you know, we haven't really seen information about the need for having a ramp at all. People currently just launch off the beach there. If there is a need, then we would recommend that it be looked at closer to the north end of the beach where there's other amenities already, like watercraft rentals, food, restoration, restrooms, and things like that. And so that'd be one thing we'd like to see reconsidered for Alternative 3. Otherwise, again, I want to thank everyone for what has been a very good process, and look forward to engaging further. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Kirk Robinson.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My family, first of all, my connection in Meeks Bay is my family owns the cabin directly across from the entrance to the South Beach. It's adjacent to the project area, upstream from the Highway 89 bridge. And all members of the family fully support the basic concept of Option 3, which is the full restoration of the creek, the elimination of any pier on the lake. And I say this by saying, what I really do encourage is you look forward to what Meeks Bay can become rather than looking to the past and trying to replicate what Meeks Bay once appeared to be to many people. And that is a haven for power boats and so on. It's not. And I think the problem that we often face when we try to accommodate every form of recreation or every form of anything, quite frankly, is some of them are potentially mutually exclusive. And I say this principally in response to the power boaters. I understand their desire to, you know, keep what has always been. But basically, the power boaters have the run of the lake anyway, whereas places where you can go and swim and enjoy the lake, whether you're just laying on the beach or paddling around on a paddleboard or a kayak, as soon as you introduce the power boats, it scares the others off. It makes it uncomfortable, if you will. And, you know, I can walk to the beach, so parking's not an issue, but when I get over there and, you know, and I can go back many years, the family's been there for almost 100 years, me not so much, but I do remember that when the power boats were all across the beach at Meeks Bay, and it wasn't real fun to go down and try and swim amongst the power boats. Somebody earlier asked, why is ACID providing non-motorized facilities is a challenge? Why is it a challenge? I would think providing facilities for power boats would be more of a challenge in terms of cost and expense and operational costs. So I just go back and encourage everybody to look at this and look to what we want in the future with climate and all the other changes that are going on, and maybe come to the recognition that a non-motorized center for me at Meeks Bay for the lake would be an ideal way to handle the future of Meeks Bay. So thank you very much for allowing me to comment.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Julie Hutchinson can address the ARPIC.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry, having internet issues here. I want to thank you all. I'm one of the forum members. My family has resided in the West Shore for about 70 years, so we have a long history here at Meeks Bay. I do appreciate the opportunity to be part of the forum and some of the outreach that has occurred to the public. I think there's still quite a bit more that will need to be done moving forward to make sure we incorporate everybody in the area. And what I have found most important is through this forum, we have actually found that we have a lot of things in common and a lot of goals in common, especially with protecting Meeks Creek and restoring that to protect the lake, which is the critical goal in this whole process. And there's also a lot of people that want to see this remain as a non-motorized, as those existing uses of the marina and boat have been gone for about 6 years now, so really no longer exists there. Since the marina has been determined to not be feasible, I think TRPA has the ability to replace those boat mooring slips, buoys, whatever you want to call them, in other areas of the West Shore that people can have the same recreation experience of having their boat stored somewhere. People did not keep their boats in Meeks Bay so that they could pull out into the bay and just sit there. They wanted to explore the lake. So what we're trying to replace is boat moorings for people who live in the area who are camping who want to store their boats, not an opportunity for more boats to come into the bay just to anchor at a dock and take over the beaches. So I think TRP has an opportunity to fill that void by reallocating some of those spaces, maybe not all of them, but finding partnerships with maybe the HOAs or other marinas on the lake to incorporate and fill that void so people have a place to keep their boat. I also want to state that the pier does not replace a marina. I'm very concerned with the consideration of a pier the length of a football field being placed anywhere in Meeks Bay, as it does not even seem feasible or environmentally sound in that bay. A pier would forever alter the bay, create noise and safety issues, and does not meet the purpose and need of the project in any way. It actually creates a more management and safety issue in the Meeks Bay. It's not consistent with the existing non-motorized uses, and I think that really needs to be looked at, as it's just not a feasible thing, and it transfers a problem from a marina out into the lake environmentally, which is not good. Another big issue for me is the recent discussion regarding the fire department's claim or need for a location to store a fireboat. That really must be assessed further, as just having an opportunity to get a boat lift due to the restoration project does not in any way demonstrate this is the right location for this resource. There must be a comprehensive, fact-based, and informative public process with the fire agencies and boards and the communities, as well as, frankly, a lake-wide master plan for who has what responsibilities in the lake, as this really becomes a mission creep and some unfunded liabilities for the different agencies without a master plan for how to handle emergencies on the lake. But I think this specialty type of equipment, the jurisdictional responsibilities and such must be considered, and to validate that Meeks Bay is even the best location for such a resource. A lot of unintended consequences for the communities with regards to public safety if these decisions are based merely on an opportunity versus a thoughtful and fact-based strategic and operational plan. The public served by Meeks Bay Fire Station must understand the consequences of unstaffing our fire station to respond to fireboat for training or emergency incidents will leave our communities without fire and emergency medical response for extended periods of time. It's a slippery slope for each property owner and the community as a whole regarding emergency response, insurance coverage at a minimum, if this isn't validated to be the right place for that resource. More work must be done before this is even considered as part of the Meeks Bay Restoration Project. I'm also concerned with the merging of the two beaches and trying to keep those very separate and distinct beach feelings and crowds a bit separated. And as was discussed earlier, do not support the movement of the South Beach parking lot all the way to the back, where it creates additional traffic and congestion and stresses on people trying to get to the beach back and forth. It will encourage people to bring large wagons and things to carry things from the far away parking lot, and will actually disrupt the campground even more than before. I encourage the TRPA and land use decision makers to take a thoughtful approach based on what Meeks Bay is, and avoid trying to create some other destination. Protect existing uses and avoid disenfranchising those who live in the bay and adjacent, as well as the communities nearby and the generations that have recreated here, by attempting to bring more tourists and people as we have been at capacity for years. And all of this should be based
I'm sorry. I kept waiting for where you might pause. But
sorry.
You've used up your 3 minutes, but I appreciate your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll provide it in writing as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next commenter, Maureen Montgomery. If you unmute yourself, you'll be able to address the RPIC.
Hi, I'm Maureen Montgomery, and I live at in the Glen Ridge subdivision. And I am not speaking for the neighborhood, although I have encouraged all of them to reach out and to submit their concerns about the different proposals. But there's about 45 homes in the Glen Ridge neighborhood, and only 7 are year-round residents, and we're one of them. I'm very pleased with so many of the great comments of the public today regarding their concerns about keeping Meeks Bay non-motorized, as well as the potential of not, I might have missed out on this part of the conversation earlier, but the whole aspect of having a pier to me does not seem to be a very useful idea. First of all, the length of a 300-foot pier is as noted before, really kind of negates the whole idea of not having motorized vehicles, having boats pulling up. I really enjoy swimming in the bay, having that the area fenced off from boats or, you know, line buoyed off. Really makes it a pleasure. I don't spend a ton of time on the beach because it's typically so crowded down there, but the swimming is excellent. And not having boats coming in and out for the last couple of years has been just a pleasure. So we encourage the restoration of the lagoon. We applaud that. It's an eyesore right now. But we also do not want to see any more boats in the bay, as few as possible. And why we need to have a pier at all is kind of beyond me. So anyways.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate that.
Yep. Anyways, that's it. And thank you so much.
Steve Teixeira, you unmute on your end. Go ahead. Thank you.
Good afternoon or good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Teixeira, for the record, and my company is Sustainable Community Advocates. In this capacity, I assist the Tahoe Basin Fire Chiefs with grant funding and planning matters. I have been actively engaged in the planning process for the Meeks Bay Restoration Project, including the recent development of an initial range of project alternatives. I want to focus our collective attention this morning on the importance of including a pier with a fireboat lift in the preferred final alternative. As discussed, this element of the project is currently described in Alternative 1. During the process of developing its new shoreline plan, adopted by the Governing Board in October of 2018, the Board formally recognized the importance of allowing for emergency access to the lake based on specific regulations and guidelines. There is currently no formal emergency access pier or boat lift serving the West Shore. According to officials from the Meeks Bay and North Tahoe Fire Protection Districts, over a recent three-year period, there were 164 emergency incidents on the lake, beach, dock, marina, or shoreline locations within the combined 35 miles of shoreline served by these two fire districts. There is clearly a need for formal emergency access to the lake on the West Shore. Meeks Bay is an ideal location. It is the home of Meeks Bay Fire's Station 61, along with a fire station operated by the U.S. Forest Service. The proposed pier and fireboat lift would be in close proximity to Station 61, which is staffed year-round, and there's backup involved if the crew there has to go out on either a land or a lake emergency. Meeks Bay Fire and North Tahoe Fire are partners in serving the West Shore north of Emerald Bay. North Tahoe Fire has allocated $128,000 for the acquisition of a fireboat, and plans are in place to fully fund and staff the fireboat, which can serve not only the West Shore, but come to the assistance of other emergency agencies around the lake when needed. There are emergency cooperative agreements in place so that there is a plan for responding to emergencies and disasters lakewide, and this would be an important component of that. Thanks for understanding the need to include a pier and a fireboat lift when the time comes to select the final alternative for the Meeks Bay Restoration Project. And we know that, as has been discussed, the final alternative can mix and match elements of the existing alternatives that are being presented to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
David Kogleiser, I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Go ahead and address the RPIC.
Yes, hi, thank you. My family has been coming up to Lake Tahoe since 1949. In particular at Meeks Bay with the Kellett family. So we have a long connection, and we've had a place in Rubicon Bay since 1984. And I'm an active member in our very large homeowner association. My belief is that at Lake Tahoe, we already have too many piers. We already have too much of this beautiful lake that has been hurt by too many piers, too many houses, too many cars, etc. So my sincere hope is that with Meeks Bay, which is a spectacular bay, very unusual for the West Shore of Lake Tahoe, that we could go with alternative number 3 and not go with this very costly eyesore of a pier. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine, is that the end of the public comments?
Mr. Chair, we have no more hands raised.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'll close the public comment period and bring it back. Unless there's any further comments from my colleagues, I'll move to agenda item 4. Hearing nothing, I'll move to this, agenda item 4, which you can find beginning at page 403 of our governing package, which is a discussion and possible recommendation for Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan Amendments to encourage more workforce housing development, expand opportunities for additional multi-residential land uses where already allowed and in community service districts align allowable multi-person densities with multi-family densities, remove limitation on affordable housing to seniors from 4 sub-districts, and update accessory dwelling unit requirements. And I believe Karen Fink, TRPA staff, is going to be leading this one. Am I correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Karen.
Karen Fink with TRPA's Housing Program. Today, Placer County is going to be presenting the first amendment of the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan. And Pat Dobbs from Placer County's Planning Services Division is here to give the presentation. So the focus of these amendments is to allow and encourage more workforce housing types, to make it easier to use bonus units for workforce housing, and also to encourage more of Placer County's remaining allocations to be used for workforce housing. This will not only help us achieve regional plan and area plan housing and walkable communities goals, but it will also help Placer County meet their regional housing needs assessments requirements that are set by the state of California. And there's two aspects of these amendments that I want to point out before I turn it over to Pat. One is that the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan draws on local government housing programs that are built into the regional plan. So where a local government has a specific affordable housing program or a moderate income housing program that is equal or more effective in meeting and supporting regional plan goals, they gain access to additional incentives, such as having being able to build accessory dwelling units on smaller parcels. Also, you're going to hear today how the amendments propose to increase multi-person densities. And a multi-person land use is a dorm room or a senior living unit or a room in a boarding house. These increases that are proposed do not alter our growth management system or allow for more growth than was analyzed in the regional plan in 2012. They're consistent with our growth management system. So finally, these amendments are an example of the local effort to address the workforce housing challenges. Simultaneously, TRPA and our partners are also working on a regional effort to address these challenges through the Tahoe Living Strategic Initiative, which is the subject of an agenda item on the governing board agenda later today. So the local and the regional efforts inform each other. So now I'm going to turn it over to Pat. He's going to give more detail about the amendments. And at the end of the presentation, we will ask RPIC to recommend approval of the amendments to the governing board and recommend approval of a finding of no significant effect. Thanks. Pat, you're on mute. You're still muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, thanks. Hear you. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Patrick Dobbs from Placer County's Planning Services Division. And if we could maybe skip a couple slides, just give the RPIC members a quick, that was to be Karen's slide, which she described. So here we go. It's great to be back with you this morning. I previously presented to RPIC seeking your feedback and direction on these proposed housing related amendments to Placer County's Tahoe Basin Area Plan that was adopted in 2017. Today, we're asking RPIC for a formal recommendation to the governing board to approve the proposed area plan amendments. There are no changes to TRPA's environmental policy regarding growth management or resource protection measures. There is no known controversy with the proposed amendments. I just have six slides, so it'll be a quick presentation. Just some quick background here. These proposed amendments build off the needs identified by the Mountain Housing Council and the Tahoe Truckee Community Foundation. TRPA's 2018 Development Rights Strategic Initiative, and as well as ongoing conversations with the California Tahoe Conservancy, members of the public, and further development of Placer County's housing element policies. Our goal is to align the area plan with state law and TRPA policy to provide a greater mix of housing types that creates an inventory of full-time workforce housing units. You may be aware of the state housing law changes regarding accessory dwelling units that went into effect in January of 2020. This meant that the Tahoe Basin Area Plan was not consistent with state law, and Placer County is required by law to update our code. So Karen just touched on last summer, the governing board tasked the APC with organizing a working group committee, the Tahoe Living Housing Community Revitalization Initiative, to develop regional strategies and solutions. Next slide, please. Just some context here for you. Placer County's area plan, Tahoe Basin Area Plan, covers our entire land area within the basin. We have about 1,000 remaining vacant residential parcels. Approximately 500 of those parcels are currently buildable, which is to say that they have an IPES score, or an individual parcel evaluation score, of over 726. Through TRPA's performance review system, we anticipate we will earn or receive an additional 500 allocations through 2032. And these allocations have historically been used for low density single family homes. And as you know, as a result of increased real estate values, this has resulted in an existing home inventory that's become out of reach for most of those earning local wages. And this has created a number of social, environmental, and economic impacts that we're trying to address. The fourth bullet here, these amendments are very technical, but at their core, they're aimed at facilitating a shift so that more of our allocations are utilized for these workforce housing types. They really focus primarily on three areas: multi-residential development, accessory dwelling units, and better utilization of the transfer of development rights systems that are in place. And it's important for me to emphasize that the thing we paid most attention to was ensuring that we were consistent with the regional plan, and especially the growth management caps and provisions. Next slide, please. I've grouped the amendments into four components, the first component being multi-residential development. And when I say multi-residential, I'm referring to three different land use types. Multifamily, which I think we're familiar with, apartments, townhomes, and such. Employee housing, that is just what it sounds like. Employee housing can be located on-site or off-site of the employer. And Karen touched on multi-person housing, which is dormitory style. These are typically unrelated occupants with shared common area facilities. So what we're trying to do with is really fill the gaps. There are a number of zone districts where maybe one or two of these multi-residential uses are currently allowed. We've made the case that multi-family, multi-person, employee housing, they have similar levels of environmental impacts and compatibility considerations. And so what this really means is that, I mean, generally speaking, we're adding multi-person and employee housing land use types where multi-family is currently permissible. They'd be regulated under the same entitlement process. So if a multi-family project requires a minor use permit, you know, so too would a multi-person land use type project. So the same entitlement process, same levels of density or density equivalence. I'm going to talk about that in a moment as it relates to multi-person. The second bullet here, there is one exception, and that is the Kings Beach Industrial Zone. Single family dwellings are allowed as an accessory to a primary commercial or industrial use, but currently there are no multifamily uses that are allowed within the Kings Beach Industrial Zone. The change would permit multifamily uses subject to a discretionary minor use permit. They would be limited to affordable through achievable income levels only. And this is really just a result of talks with the California Tile Conservancy about properties they own in the Kings Beach Industrial Zone District that are potentially well suited for these types of multi-residential developments. The third bullet here is multi-person density increase, and most land uses measure density in units per acre. Multi-person land use measures density in people per acre. Fortunately, TRPA has an equivalency factor that says that for every 2.5 people equals one allocation. So this results in multi-person densities of 25, 37, or 62 people per acre as you vary from the zone district transitions from more of the rural into the town centers. Next slide, please. This is multi-residential development continued. So again, this first component, we would add special designations and policies to zone districts where these multi-residential uses are allowed to enable the transfer of the necessary development rights so that these projects can assemble the commodities needed to facilitate the project. The second bullet, we have four districts currently. Two of them are in the Lake Forest Glen area, one is in Dollar Hill and one is in Tahoma. They limit affordable housing to senior citizens. We would strike that language, strike that limitation, and enable affordable housing for all demographics. The third bullet here, Placer County, I believe, is the only jurisdiction within the basin with TRPA recognized local government housing programs. This is what allows Placer County to permit accessory dwelling units on parcel less than 1 acre. This amendment would recognize Placer County as having as a certified local government moderate income housing program. This is really just a recognition of the programs that are underway at the county, such as our workforce housing preservation program, which is based off of Vail's Indeed program. And what this means, Karen touched on it, but TRPA is recognizing our housing programs as equal or more effective to the regional programs that are in place to accelerate workforce housing, and would give Placer County access to the different pools of these development rights held by TRPA, and would provide maximum flexibility to assemble the rights needed to deliver these types of housing. Next slide, please. This slide is going to cover the second, third, and fourth components. Accessory dwelling units, we are in this unique situation where California housing law and TRPA regulations have diverged. The ADU laws that went into effect in California last year removed the county's ability to consider things like land coverage. We can't deed restrict based on affordability requirements. And if the ADU meets objective development standards like setbacks and height, then they must be approved ministerially. These changes would establish a two-step permitting process that would basically delete the existing language and ADU development standards in the area plan and replace it with language that establishes this two-step process whereby Placer County would apply state law and TRPA would apply the regional plan regulations as it relates to accessory dwelling units. The second bullet there under ADUs is regarding parking, and the amendments would establish alternative parking standards for ADUs, and they would establish a maximum of one additional parking space for accessory dwelling units, and there would be a number of additional scenarios where no additional parking would be required, for instance, when you're in proximity to public transit stops. So certainly that wouldn't preclude a project proponent from proposing additional parking, even if it wasn't required. But these ADU changes are consistent with state law. And as we've discussed, TRPA is working on kind of a regional solution to address this issue. The third, or number three, the third component deals with development right conversions, and this would align the area plan with TRPA's 2018 development rights strategic initiative. When there is a conflict between the regional plan and an area plan, the more restrictive provision applies. So this would enable Placer County to take better advantage of the banking, transfer, and conversions of development right that you have in place. The fourth component is just really cleanup and minor amendments. This involves cross references, consistent terminology, and the addition of threshold related facilities throughout all the districts in the area plan. So threshold related facilities are environmental monitoring stations where someone maybe would have an air quality monitoring station or something like that. It would enable those as a permissible use subject to a discretionary minor use permit throughout the basin. So those are really just the four components, how we've bundled these amendments, multi-residential development, accessory dwelling units, updates regarding banking conversions and transfer of development rights and cleanup. Next slide, please. So we're getting close to having these amendments adopted. We hope to conclude this first round of amendments to the Tahoe Basin Area Plan next month, following scheduled presentations to the APC and Governing Board in February. We have, back in July, we went to our North Tahoe Regional Advisory Council. Again, in August of 2020, I presented to you seeking direction on these amendments. We, in November and December of last year, we brought forward the amendments to the Placer County Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors. The amendments were unanimously approved without any public comment or controversy. So again, today we're at the Yellow Star. We're asking RPIC to recommend approval of the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan amendments to the Governing Board. These area plans are intended to be dynamic as we're implementing the area plan and see areas that are not working as well as they could. We're going to keep coming back to assume more delegation authority, provide flexible standards and a more streamlined process for these types of desired development, and enhance the quality of life and environment in Placer County and accelerate attainment of the regional environmental thresholds. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can answer your questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate all the work that you have put into this and all Placer County staff and the board and the planning commissions. Any comments from my colleagues on the committee regarding the presentation you've heard and review of the materials that were sent out to us regarding the changes to the Placer County Area Plan, Tahoe Basin Area Plan?
Hey, Bill, I have a quick question for Patrick.
Sure.
Patrick, remind us, what is the mechanism? This doesn't relate to any of the proposed amendments. I think the amendments are fine. I have no issue with them. But what is the mechanism that the county uses to ensure that these affordable housing units are actually occupied by people who work in the basin?
Ms. Aldean, if I understand the question correctly, I don't believe there is a requirement that the people live in the basin. We're striving for that, but my understanding is
Patrick, work in the basin. I mean, this is being sold as workforce housing. I'm a big advocate for workforce housing. Obviously, the objective is to provide people with housing in the basin so they don't have to commute from various valley locations.
Sure. So
Patrick,
my understanding is that, sorry, go ahead, someone.
This is Cindy Gustafson. Okay. I do believe our deed restriction program allows people to work within the Tahoe Truckee Unified School District boundaries, Shelley, so there could be people that live in the basin and one or both would work in the Truckee area or just outside the basin in Squaw or North Star as well. I think that's currently how that works, Patrick, but we can check on that.
Well, that would
yes,
be great.
Supervisor, you're correct that you know we're working within the fair housing laws and we are establishing programs that incentivize local housing, and it is at this time being based on, I believe, school district boundaries.
Okay. Another question. Are these units still available to existing occupants after they retire and are no longer a part of the workforce?
I think, as I understand, some of the details of those programs are still, where we're just launching some of these programs. So I'm not sure.
Okay,
I don't know about going in and asking people to leave since they've retired. That seems...
Yeah, and to Shelley's point, we need to check on this, Patrick, but I do know that the Workforce Housing Preservation Program is going to require people to work at least 7 years before retiring. But those are for those property purchase deed restriction properties. So I'm not sure if that applies here. So we'll need to check on that. But good point, Shelley.
Well, and I was going to ask a similar question when we deal at the governing board level with the related company project in South Lake Tahoe. I mean, everybody would love to live at Lake Tahoe, but I think what we want to avoid is having these affordable housing units taken up by people who want to come to the basin and retire at an affordable, you know, occupying an affordable unit. I mean, that's not the objective of this exercise. The objective is to improve the circumstances of people who are already living in the basin, you know, who have substandard housing. So however we can best do that, I really think we need to kind of have a laser focus on implementing policies that don't allow any sort of abuse of these affordable housing units by people who don't work in the basin and are just, as I say, looking for an affordable place to live, who may be living outside of the basin currently.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments from my colleagues? Okay, let's open it up to a public comment, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Teixeira, go ahead and address the RPIC.
Thank you, Catherine.
Mr. Chair.
Appreciate the opportunity again for the record, Steve Teixeira. Business advocate, and during my 47-year career at Tahoe, I've been fortunate to advocate for the businesses on the North Shore when I was the CEO of the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association, and more recently as CEO of Tahoe Chamber, advocating for businesses on the South Shore. This is really an important step forward that Placer County has taken, not only to be consistent with new California law, but also to be in line with the direction that TRPA is going with a more regional solution for some of our affordable housing needs, which are, as you all know, very critical. So this is a great step forward, and I want to commend Supervisor Gustafson, all the members of the Board of Supervisors, and all the folks up and down the chain in Placer County, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, for their work on this. It is detailed, it is technical, but it's extremely important, and I'm just glad to be here today to support these amendments and ask for RPIC to recommend them forward to the governing board. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make public comment on this item.
Okay, well, I'll bring this back. We have two motions, page 403 of the governing board packet, or maybe Karen has something up on the slide that I can't see. If there are any other comments, I'm happy to receive comments or for someone to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, this is Cindy. I have 2 points first before making the motion. To Shelley's point, you are right on target with where we're at within the boundaries of the law, and the Fair Housing Act is our only restriction. And so certainly we're not going through this exercise of Placer County without the intent that these are people working in our community, in and around our community. So we'll get answers for you on those restrictions. I know, as I mentioned on the preservation program, which is not subject to today's motions, we have developed that program. But I'm not sure what rules we have. And unless Patrick can reach Shauna Pervines right now, I whatever is legal, we will implement to assure ourselves that this housing is for people working in the basin, in and around the basin. Because you're absolutely right. We don't want to see this become something for others who might want to use the program.
For Cindy.
I appreciate that clarification. Thank you, Cindy.
Yeah, and I do think there's some legal issues. Karen might know more about that as to how the Fair Housing Act works, as to how closely we can restrict where people work. You know, Karen?
I know there are some issues with finding out where the person's income comes from, but I believe that Placer County has some good models for that in the Workforce Housing Preservation Program. And I also want to point out that most of these workforce housing units will take advantage of TRPA's bonus unit program. So they will get a bonus unit in exchange for an affordable, moderate, or achievable deed restriction, which requires that the income be restricted and that the person be a local resident. So that's, we've been using that deed restriction for many years. So most of these units will take advantage of that, although they don't all have to.
Great. So with
okay, go ahead.
Unless there's other questions on that item, I would make the required motion to recommend the governing board approval of the required findings, and including a finding of no significant effect for adoption of draft amendments to the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan as provided in attachment D of the staff report.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Any questions about the motion? I guess, Tracy, if you'll have to call the roll on the motion, please.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Ms. Aldean?
Yes.
And Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the motion carries.
Thank you very much. And
with that, Mr. Chair, I would follow up with a second motion to recommend governing board adoption of ordinance 2021 dash amending 2017-01 to amend the Placer County Tahoe Basin Area Plan to include the changes referenced in attachments B and C of the staff report.
Thank you, Cindy. Tracy, would you open a roll again for the second motion?
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Ms. Aldean?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
And Mr. Yates?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Well, thank you all, and appreciate all that Placer County and staff have done on pushing a good affordable housing program. And further clarifications before the governing board, that would be great. Thank you, Cindy. So now we're moving to items. The next items are items 5 and combining 5 and 6, which are the discussions of a direction on amending the existing nitrate deposition threshold standard AQ14 to a per capita VMT standard to reduce reliance on the automobile, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and to promote mobility, and to discuss a possible direction on implementing mechanisms to accelerate attainment of the per capita VMT standard, including revisions to the transportation project impact assessment and air quality mitigation fee of TRPA Code Section 65.2, and amendments to the goals and policies of the regional plan. And you can find this information at beginning at page 577 of our governing board packet for today's meeting. And I believe that the executive director, Joanne Marquette, is going to lead this off.
I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. These next two combined committee items really relate to TRPA's strategic initiative on transportation. I want to set some expectations about timing. Ordinarily, we would not make, you know, a presentation that certainly exceeded about 30 minutes. But by combining these two, our expectation is that this is going to be a fairly long presentation. So it's in three parts. I'm going to introduce it. Dan Siegel will follow me, and Melanie after that. So this is going to be about an hour of talk. And so we'd like folks, you know, jot notes, take down thoughts. But what we're hoping to do is to help you see how all these pieces work together. So now would be, you know, the right time to get a glass of water or a snack or something like that. In any event, and the reason we're doing it this way is because transportation is perhaps one of the most difficult areas of our regional planning context to simplify and explain in a way that people fully understand it, because there are so many players and so many related moving puzzle pieces to fit together in order to make the system work. Okay, it's really easy to get drawn down into the weeds and to lose sight of this bigger picture, both on what are we wanting to accomplish and what part of the system are we working on. So our first task today, and I drew the straw on this, before we jump into any of the specifics, is to help you see both of these things, what we're proposing to accomplish in transportation and why, and what the moving puzzle pieces are that are going to get us to that desired outcome. So Dan Sagan and I have teamed up. I'm going to introduce to you a thought frame that's drawn directly from the compact that allows you to fit these moving puzzle pieces together and show you how they connect up in the compact's big picture. Dan then is going to put some additional flesh on those bones of that of those puzzle pieces, okay? We're going to show you by the end of today's discussion that since 2015, we have been touching and updating and adapting and making more effective every relevant puzzle piece in Tahoe's transportation system, from its measures of success that are in the form of threshold standards and the transportation model that we use to measure those standards, to the plans. You know, we start at the top of the pyramid threshold, then we go to plans to achieve the intended measures. Those plans have implementation strategies, and then how do we get those strategies implemented? Then we have to think about the funding that we need to implement those strategies in the enhanced plans. So for almost 6 years, we have focused work and emphasis on transportation in the region. And now we're poised finally to bring a lot of these puzzle pieces of an integrated system of land use and transportation for Tahoe, you know, really up to date for the 21st century. And all of that groundwork has been developing for about a decade, okay? So we started over a decade ago where the compact has us start. The compact says, what is the regional vision? What are the values and desired outcomes for the region and land use and transportation? That first puzzle piece was put in place in 2012 when the region coalesced around and adopted what was then the most widely supported community vision for the future of Tahoe since really the 1980s. It was the 2012 regional plan update and the regional transportation plan update that created this vision of sustainable communities that integrated our transportation system so that we could generate reduced reliance on the automobile. What did we do then? We strengthened our land use incentives to alter Tahoe's land use pattern in order to create compact, walkable, bikeable community centers that favored reduced traffic, that favored affordable and workforce housing near transit, all in order to reduce reliance on the private auto as called for by the compact. Okay, that sustainable community strategy also had the benefit of implementing the California state policies on AB 32, which was greenhouse gas reduction, on SB 375 that was linking land use and transportation planning. So our plan was fully consistent with those state laws. So the 2012 community vision, that 2012 community vision was also important because it maintained all of Tahoe's enforceable system of growth control. It's a system that's been in place for 40 years where all of our development in Tahoe is capped. And so we have minimal growth. What minimal growth there is metered out. It's metered out slowly to the point where it's almost negligible. And most of that development in the region is either redevelopment of existing buildings or transfers of development. So we've strengthened the land use side in 2012 and then again in 2015 when we brought forward our development rights initiative. All of that was to meet the objectives of the Sustainable Communities Foundation of our regional plan. It was in 2015 that we turned our emphasis to the transportation side of the Sustainable Communities vision. That was when the governing board approved our first transportation strategic initiative, as well as a strategic initiative to bring our threshold standards up to date and based, you know, so that they were based on current science. We have been steadily working to update, improve, accelerate, bring all of that current, bring every part of our transportation system current, from the definitions on the standards of success that we call threshold standards, the enhancements to the plans and implementing strategies that would implement the threshold standard, and then the focused work that we need to do on securing funding to achieve those plans. Okay, so with the vision and values defined in 2012, we moved on to answer the question, what are the measures of success of that 2012 transportation and sustainable communities vision? So under our threshold update initiative, the very top priority was updating a dated 1982 air quality standard for nitrogen emissions. That air quality standard is our present VMT standard. Dan is going to talk to you more about how that current VMT standard isn't now and never has been related to or scientifically tied in any way to the implementation of Tahoe's transportation vision that's set out in the RTP. He's going to summarize, therefore, a proposal to you for a new VMT per capita standard as being the right goal for success. And he's going to show you how that standard is closely tied to our 21st century transportation vision, as well as the integrated land use sustainable community system that's in our regional plan. So here's the next piece of the complex puzzle about our transportation system. It's what is the plan for achieving that threshold? The new transportation and sustainable communities threshold standard that we'll review today is only as good as the plans and programs that we designed to achieve it. So that's why we're also in the process right now of preparing the next four-year update of Tahoe's RTP, our regional transportation plan. As the MPO for the region, we do that every 4 years. So we strengthened the policies and programs of that RTP in 2016. We're doing it now again in 2020. And that 2020 RTP, another piece of the puzzle, is on the street and it's ready for approval. And it emphasizes transportation strategies that are all designed around addressing visitation congestion, reducing automobile reliance, implementing state policy on AB 32, greenhouse gas emissions, as well as now Nevada's corresponding state policies on greenhouse gas emissions, as well as California's policies in SB 375. So next up, in addition to updating the plan and the threshold, now we're tackling action items that will actually implement that threshold, first at the plan level of the RTP, and then also at the project level. So at the plan level, I want to talk about what action is underway. we all know implementing our RTP comes with a hefty price tag. It's a $2.5 billion plan of transportation and sustainable communities investments, with a long list of capital and other projects to be accomplished over 25 years. That's why at the plan level, we're increasing investment in transportation. That increase in investment is the single most effective way to accelerate RTP implementation and to make sure that we have the resources that we need. The two states have helped us by engaging two rounds of ongoing transportation consultation among the implementing partners. So the states of California and Nevada convened the DOTs and the local governments and the private sector, among other partners. That first consultation in 2017-18 produced a final report that identified transportation's highest priorities. What were the highest priorities in the RTP that could make the biggest difference on addressing the Tahoe region's biggest challenge, which is out-of-basin visitation traffic that clogs our roads at peak times? So if we got new money, what would we use it on? We were looking at what were our highest transportation priorities. Then there was a second convening, and that's still underway. And that effort is looking at how to secure new sources of funding to implement our RTP highest priorities. A target has been set to reach a widely supported bi-state stakeholder consensus on the approach to new funding sources for our transportation system implementation, and to reach that consensus by the end of 2021. So there's going to be more on that action plan at today's EIP and Transportation Committee meeting. So RPIC is not the only committee that's working on moving our transportation system forward. And then lastly, in the system, so we looked at the plan level, funding at the plan level, which helps us implement the RTP. We're also now looking at the project level. And the question there is, how do we apply this new threshold measure, this new VMT per capita threshold measure to development projects? So development, and this is in the basin mostly meaning redevelopment, is only a very small increment of how we actually implement our RTP, because it accounts for only about 3% of regional BMT. Nonetheless, part of any improved transportation implementation system needed to look at a better way of assessing whether a redevelopment project would actually have a significant effect on BMT at the project level. So how would we do that, and how would projects then mitigate those potential VMT effects? Today, we're going to outline this updated framework for assessing whether a development project has a significant effect on the VMT threshold that we're going to be proposing. So you see these multiple moving pieces of the puzzle for achieving our transportation and sustainable communities vision: a VMT threshold update, a 2020 RTP update for implementing that threshold, a bi-state consultation, and funding initiative to secure added investment in transportation, and a project-level assessment methodology for determining whether development projects will actually have a significant effect on that new BMT threshold. So the last thing I really want to address here is why is what we're developing better than the system we have in place today? We've heard lots of people say, you're not doing enough about cars and congestion, do it faster, you're not trying hard enough. So today we change that frame, because what we're proposing so far is a more effective system than the one we currently have. And it will accelerate implementation. It checks the box on all of the important required outcomes that we need. We're updating to a more relevant VMT standard. We're designing around strategies which, when implemented, will actually not only decrease per capita VMT growth, but it's also going to hold absolute VMT to near zero over 25 years. That is an outcome that's not just consistent with, but it actually outperforms. It exceeds all of the related statewide requirements that we've tried to design around. So AB 32, SB 375, SB 743, and Nevada's climate plan goals. Lastly, it checks the box on funding. This bi-state transportation consultation is committed to solutions for increasing our transportation investment. So we've tied to the bi-state funding, and we tied the new VMT threshold to the bi-state funding initiative, to the interim goals of an updated RTP. We've tied it to land use and transportation policies of the state, and it's related to those statutory goals for GHG reduction, for sustainable communities, for affordable housing, and for the SB 743 considerations about how we assess projects. So all of that taken together is more proactive, more ambitious than anything we've done to date in transportation. It would bring Tahoe's transportation and land use system fully up to date for the 21st century. So what are we doing in RPIC today? We're bringing you two puzzle pieces of that updated transportation framework. With everything else that's in the work, we're going to bring two pieces today. After Dan rounds out this contextual framework that I've outlined, he will then summarize the approach for a new mobility-based threshold standard that uses VMT per capita as its measure of success. And then Melanie Sloan is going to outline to you the framework for how that threshold gets applied and assessed at a project level. And from what do we want from you at RPIC today? We're not bringing you any final proposals today. There are still details of both of these pieces that we're continuing to work with our partners. But what we are looking for is any input that you may have and your endorsement to proceed to finalize the proposals that will make these two framework proposals for VMT per capita on threshold standard and for the project assessment tool. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Dan, and he'll take it from here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joanne. I appreciate the overview. And Dan, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee and members of the public. My name is Dan Segan, TRPA staff in the Research and Analysis Unit. And just to give you an idea of how all these puzzle pieces come together that Joanne talked about in the last segment, providing high-level context, I just want to emphasize we are not bringing a final proposal today. We are still working through many of the details with our numerous partners in this effort. But what we are coming to you for is a routine check-in to ensure that we are headed in the right direction. You provided us direction in March that initially set off the most recent round here. We checked in again in July to assure that we're on course. And we're looking for a head nod today that suggests that we are still headed in the right direction and that we should continue to finalize these proposals and fully flesh them out. Next slide, please. As Joanne touched on, most people, when they think about the VMT standard today, mistakenly think that it was originally adopted as a transportation goal for the region. But in fact, it owes its adoption to many of the same concerns that motivated about a third of our standards in 1982. And those were concerns around the clarity of our lake. At the time, many of you already know, it was believed that excess algal growth was responsible for declining clarity. And as you also probably know, nitrogen is both a byproduct of combustion and a nutrient that supports algal growth. So it was critical to the early threshold standards to control nitrogen. Next slide, please. And since that time, really over the last 40 years, two things have changed. The first was the nearly $10 million in science invested to better understand clarity that ultimately led to the development of the Lake Tahoe TMDL, which is the science-based strategy to restore the clarity of our lake over the next 65 years. And what that science really highlighted for us is that it was not actually algal growth that was primarily responsible for declining clarity, but it was that it was inorganic fine sediment particles that were actually responsible for about two-thirds of the clarity loss. Next slide, please. And the second thing that's happened since that time is that cars have gotten a lot cleaner. A new car that you purchase today would have to drive about 100 miles to emit the same amount of NOx that the average car did in 1975 when the EPA first started adopting clean emissions standards. And what that means, if you go to the next slide, is that we've dramatically changed the emissions landscape within our landscape and the relationship fundamentally between VMT and NOx emissions, both in our region, but also around the world. And really what you see here is that the original standard that called for a 10% reduction in nitrogen deposition from 1981 values has been attained many times over. We are currently at about a third of what emissions were in 2000, and emissions in 2000 were far lower than they were in 1980. And we're forecasted to continue to go on that trajectory of reducing emissions farther and farther. Next slide, please. If this is the first time that you are hearing that maybe our VMT standard needs to be reevaluated, I'll forgive you for not reading many of our historic threshold evaluations. But the reviewers really called to attention the changing relationship between VMT and nitrogen, first in the 2001 threshold evaluation, which you see highlighted here in the recommendations that we revisit the evaluation. Next slide, please. The next round of reviewers in 2006 repeated that same recommendation. Next slide, please. The next set of threshold reviewers in 2011 repeated that same recommendation that we revisit this, and then again in 2015. And next slide, please. Maybe as one of the authors of the 2015 evaluation, we'd like to take credit for how carefully worded that recommendation was to revisit this, because after 20 years of recommending it, we actually started to include that revision of that relationship and review into our work plan. So as you know, the governing board chartered the threshold update initiative and identified review of the VMT threshold standard as one of the. I'll continue. And we identified the review and update of the VMT standard as one of the core areas that we revisit initially. And we also convened a transportation measures working group, or rather the APC convened the group at the direction of the governing board. And that group met over the series of about 6 months in 2017 and reviewed the entire landscape of how we measure progress within transportation and what measures are best suited for what causes. And if you go to the next slide, one of the things that really emerged from that effort is that we were using BMT in our discourse, and stakeholders were using BMT in our discourse in a manner that had entirely changed since it was initially adopted in 1982. Again, in 1982, it was really a concern over algal growth within the lake that motivated the adoption of the standard and motivated stakeholder comment. And in 2017, we've seen the entire landscape shift to talk about congestion or frustration with congestion, looking at greenhouse gas emissions, clearly not a concern in the 1980s, fine sediment loading, road wear, regional mobility. And really what that highlighted for us is that we needed to go back and really understand if we're going to revisit this threshold standard, why are we revisiting that and what are we trying to set a goal for? And if we go to the next slide, as Joanne mentioned, what we did here is we really started where the compact directs us to start. What's our regional vision? What are our values? And what are our desired outcomes? What is it that we're actually trying to create? What are we setting a goal for ourselves to achieve? Not just TRPA, but as a region, as the Tahoe Partnership, what are we working towards? And if you remember back in March, we had refined the comments that we heard and looked during that 2017 stakeholder process and brought a recommendation to this committee that we thought VMT-based threshold would be best suited to measure progress towards and establish a goal for, working towards three goals. That's increasing mobility within the region, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and implementing the Compact's directive to reduce dependency on the automobile. And based on the direction that you provided us in March, if you go to the next slide, please, we started thinking about, okay, if those are our goals, how can we set a standard, a threshold standard for those new goals? And fortunately, because we also kicked off the threshold standard process in 2017, we've been working with the Tahoe Science Advisory Council for the last 4 years now on how to set better goals for our region. And they've really outlined 5 criteria that are very simple and commonplace in many workplaces around the country. And they're called SMART criteria. So we need to have specific goals that we can easily measure progress towards, that are achievable within our means. They're not just aspirational. They are relevant to the concerns and people of the day, and they are time bound. We need to establish a goal when we are actually going to achieve the goal that we're working towards. It shouldn't just be in an indefinite time in the future. Next slide, please. And so as we thought about what we are trying to create, increasing mobility, implementing the Compact directive of reducing reliance on the automobile, we also took a long look at the existing thresholds that we had. And over the years, TRPA has adopted about 200 thresholds, and all of which fit into one of two categories. They are either thresholds to restore something that has been lost. Here you can think of the threshold standards for restoring SEZ or restoring the historic clarity of the lake, or protect something that we fear we are going to lose. So this is non-degradation standards for our scenic view sheds, non-degradation standards for existing SEZs within the basin, or protection of public access and a fear that we may lose more public access to the lake. And so that got us to thinking, if these are the models for how people have set threshold standards in the past, where do we look? Because if you go to the next slide, please, as many of you probably know, there's no historic point when visitors or residents of Tahoe enjoyed an experience that was not dependent on the automobile. And that is not unique to Tahoe. It is true for cities and towns all around the country and all around the world. We grew up in an auto-dependent society, and we are trying to break that. So we didn't have anyone coming to those public meetings in 2017 saying, or even in the last couple months, as we've heard comments at RPIC saying, if you could only stop everything right now, we would just be happy with the existing congestion we have. That's not what we heard. What we heard is, why don't you have more bike paths like Minneapolis? And why don't we have free transit service like they do down in Mammoth? And we realized that there was no historic precedent for what we are trying to create. But the desire for that, if you go to the next slide, this desire to create something better for the residents and visitors of Tahoe dates back at least to the compact that established us and probably much further. So this is the original compact language and the direction to TRPA that when it considers developing its regional transportation plan, that it emphasizes this multimodal transportation experience, the ability to get around without being forced to get in your car every day and for every task. Next slide, please. And perhaps because it is so ingrained in us and we've been thinking about it so long, there, as Joanne mentioned, are numerous visions for what this future might look like. And we have started to implement and work towards those visions. And we've even developed plans that will help achieve those visions. If you go to the next slide, Joanne talked about the numerous changes we made in the 2012 regional plan update that maintained those development caps that were essential to the region, but also included a whole host of incentives that would focus development in specific areas and provide workforce and affordable housing for members of our community. That is then complemented by the regional transportation plan, which again emphasizes transit, trails, and technology to provide people with different ways to get around our region. And the unique sort of role of TRPA relative to many agencies and many regions is that we have responsibility for both of these and can thus harmonize them to maximize their benefit. So if you go to the next slide, please. The real benefit of this coordinated transportation and land use planning is our ability to maximize the benefit of each of those planning efforts. And so the first two maps on the left-hand side of your screen are highlighting different incentives within the regional plan that are designed to promote additional development and redevelopment within our town centers and core parts of our community. And then if you go to the far right, we can see in the regional transportation plan, it also focuses on providing additional transportation services in those, whether it be waterborne taxi, whether it be bike routes, whether it be increased transit service to those areas as well. So the two complement each other to provide a future where we're actually making this possible, where we are focusing our development and our transportation efforts in the same areas. And as a result of that, we really have the opportunity to create something new for our region. Next slide, please. And I think that's actually a really incredible thing that we should take a moment to think about for a minute, because we've adopted so many thresholds that we've talked about before, that nearly 200, that are really motivated out of fear. Fear that we have lost something that is important to us that we need to get back, or fear that we have something today that our kids tomorrow will not be able to enjoy. And the standard that we're bringing forward to you today is actually fundamentally different than those two. It's not motivated by fear at all. It's motivated by hope and a belief that as a partnership, we can do something better, that my kids could grow up in a better Tahoe than I'm experiencing today, and that they'll have the opportunities to walk places that I never had, that they'll be able to enjoy the bike connections and transit centers that I never enjoyed, and that we didn't have the pleasure of enjoying as we experience Tahoe today. Next slide, please. So that's the context setting. And now I'm going to shift into how we went about identifying what the goal should be for our region. If you go to the next slide, Joanne mentioned that we're recommending a VMT per capita goal. And what is VMT per capita? It's really quite simple. VMT per capita is how much you and I have to drive, the distance we have to drive each day, or that the average resident or visitor to our region has to drive. And there's extensive literature and numerous state policies that suggest that people enjoy spending less time in their cars and more time enjoying the things that they like. They enjoy taking shorter trips. They enjoy not having to get in the car to take a trip at all. Many people have asked us through this process, if you go to the next slide, well, if you're doing a VMT standard, why don't you just do an absolute VMT standard? That seems just as easy. And the reason we're not recommending an absolute VMT standard is that absolute VMT and VMT per capita are fundamentally different measures that tell you different things about a community. So in a review of the 100 largest metropolitan areas of our region, the region with the lowest VMT per capita, and this will likely not surprise anyone who's visited the New York metro area, was New York City. And residents of New York drove on average less than 4,000 miles a year. But while they had extremely low VMT per capita and enjoyed being able to take transit and to work each morning and walk to the grocery store and walk to the neighborhood shop, when you look at the total VMT for the New York region, it had the second highest VMT of the 100 largest metro areas in our country. And we don't think that's because it's performing poorly or it has an inefficient transportation system. The VMT per capita actually tells us that it is a quite efficient transportation system, and it is affording the people the opportunity to take transit to work in the morning and to walk to school with their kids in the morning. It's telling us that New Yorkers spend less time and travel shorter distance in their car than the vast majority of the other cities within our region or within our country. Next slide, please. And when we thought about setting up this threshold standard, we laid out a three-step process that's relatively simple. We said, first, we need to establish how much VMT we have in our region today. That's the numerator. Then we needed to establish how many people are traveling with our region. That's our denominator. And we emphasize all travelers here because we think the goal of our transportation program is reducing reliance on the automobile, not just for residents of Tahoe, but for residents, visitors, and anyone traveling in our region. As Joanne mentioned, the bi-state consultation highlighted the importance of including and considering visitor travel and the visitor travel experience and addressing visitor travel within the transportation concerns of the region. And so we've emphasized all travelers here. So once we've set those two, the baseline amount of BMT and the baseline population, all we need to do is figure out how far we want to get in the future. What is our goal? And we organized a technical advisory committee over this past summer and held three meetings, one on each of these subjects, to receive technical feedback on how we are setting our baseline amount of BMT, how we are calculating our population, and what target we should set for them. And the proposal you see before you has benefited greatly from all those inputs. Next slide, please. In terms of actually setting that target, what did we do? How did we think about where we might be in the future? Because this wasn't just a blue sky exercise. One of the things that the Science Council emphasized to us is that your targets should be achievable. Don't just say something, don't say reduce VMT 100% without any plan to get there. A plan without, or a goal without a plan is just a wish. And so what we did is we looked at what would happen if the regional plan was effective and amendments like the Placer County Area Plan Amendment that you considered earlier today were effective in providing workforce and affordable housing for our communities. And what would happen if we implemented all those projects in the regional plan? Next slide, please. And we considered those two things and we brought them together within our travel demand model, which is fundamentally a model we use to look at what happens when we change the land use pattern in our region and change the transportation infrastructure within our region. And many of you are probably aware that after the last threshold evaluation and the last regional transportation plan in 2017, we received a number of critiques of our existing modeling. And I think we as an agency did a fair bit of soul searching that led us to believe that we could do better and that we should do better. And we organized, again, a technical model working group prioritized a suite of investments within our model that allowed us to dramatically improve the quality of our model. And the goal of all of that was to ensure that the model could be used for this exercise, to ensure that the information before you today is the best possible information that we can provide to you for policymaking on this subject. Next slide, please. And so as we thought about that, what does it mean to actually implement both? And I just want to take a moment to talk about all of the individual elements of the regional transportation plan and what the vision we are creating for ourselves and for our region in 2045 actually means, because it's a fairly impressive suite of things. So what we are talking about is having 15-minute transit service between town centers and recreation destinations throughout the region, 30 to 60-minute transit service between neighborhoods and town centers. We're talking about having waterborne taxis connecting the north and south sides of the lake and also to key destination places around the lake. And as a result of all that investment, we're going to see a five-fold increase in transit ridership by 2045. This is the plan that we are modeling. We also include completion of the multi-purpose trail around the lake. It will allow access for people with disabilities. It'll provide critical infrastructure within our communities that allow people to get to work and to specific recreation destinations from all of our neighborhoods. To do that, we're planning on building 110 new miles of bike and pedestrian trails around our region. People are going to have greater access to those trails because we're going to build 17 mobility hubs and transit centers within our region that will really provide travelers and residents with the opportunity to park their car once and then get around the region without reliance on the automobile. We're also talking about having micro transit, bike and scooter sharing that allow us to close some of those last mile things. We're talking about having trip planning tools and information kiosks that will help manage parking at key recreation sites, relieving the congestion at those pinch points, and also help visitors and residents make more informed decisions. So again, they can enjoy more time doing the things that they want and not getting there in their automobile and not looking for a parking space. We're also talking about augmenting the electric vehicle charging stations around the lake so that when you do need to use a car in our region, we are fully supporting and encouraging you to use one that does not emit anything. In short, it would completely alter our travel experience within our region. Next slide, please. So what happens if we did all that? What happens if the regional plan was successful in revitalizing and focusing additional development in our town centers, and we were able to increase transit by fivefold? What we think is possible is that we could achieve a 6.8% reduction from the baseline from per capita VMT by 2045, which would achieve all of these goals. Next slide, please. So I think typically when we reach that point in the presentation or in the discussions, and if you'll click once more, Tracy, sorry, there's sort of this moment where there's an elephant in the room because people are thinking 6.8% doesn't really sound all that great. That's not really, I was hoping for something bigger. Like, couldn't you come in with 25% reduction or something amazing like that? And so I want to take a minute to talk about why 6.8% reduction really is ambitious. And so if you go to the next slide, we'll start at just the most basic level, which is just achieving what we are regulatory obligated to achieve right now. So if we looked at the SB 375 or SB 743 target for the California side of the region, and we formulated our target the same way, by 2035, we actually expect a 10% reduction in VMT per capita relative to the overall 5% goal in 743 or in 375. So our target is both stricter and it doubles. It's twice as aggressive as what we were talking about under 375. Next slide, please. So you may also, if you're really familiar with California policy, you may also know that many other regions around the state have more aggressive targets than we do in Tahoe. So you may be thinking, yeah, but 5%, come on, like I've heard Sacramento is gonna do a 20% reduction. This is Tahoe, why can't we get to a 20% reduction? Wouldn't that be great? Next slide, please. And I wanna just ground that expectation because we are looking at the same evidence base that CARB is looking at in Sacramento for what is possible. And it's that evidence base that informed both those targets and the threshold target that we are recommending before you today. And we're fortunate enough that there's actually been a significant amount of work done on how you reduce VMT and what's the overall effectiveness of these individual efforts. Next slide, please. And unfortunately for us, what a lot of that literature says is that VMT reduction is not easy. It is incredibly hard and takes coordinated, concerted effort. And it's especially hard in rural areas like ours. And I would add a third thing on that, which isn't, but it's also especially hard when you don't expect much population growth. And I'll talk about that in a minute. If you go to the next slide, Joanne had mentioned the caps on regional development and where we stand today. So if we looked at the overall capacity for development as specified in the regional plan, we regulate three different types of development rights, commercial floor area, tourist accommodation units, and residential developments. And what you'll see, if you add all that together, the region is already 93% filled out. So of everything that could exist in the region, 93 out of 100 are already on the ground right now. So we're not gonna build all that much more. But what does that mean from a policy standpoint? So if you go to the next slide, what that means, and this really informs how also we approached the project level evaluation and what we expect of projects. And I'll illustrate through a comparison between the Tahoe region and the Sacramento region. And in each here, if you walk through this table with me, we have the existing development within our region, the expected homes or the expected new homes that we would imagine will be built here by 2035. Then we have the existing VMT per unit. These are just dummy numbers to try to make the example simple. So currently, every time we build a home in each, we're getting about 10 VMT per unit. And what if we had a policy that said, okay, let's get a 15% reduction per unit. And so every new home built in Tahoe and in Sacramento, it's only gonna produce 8.5 VMT per each unit. And then we play that out and we build all the remaining homes in each region. And what do we see? And what you see here is that for the return on investment from the policy, the Sacramento region actually sees a far larger reduction in VMT overall in its population, when you look at VMT per capita overall, than we would in Tahoe. And the reason for that is because we have cap development and because we are so near build out of our region, we're just not adding enough existing stock to make new development and cranking on new development to deliver the returns that other regions that are expected to experience higher growth have. And that's why when you look at those targets, the highest targets, the highest reduction targets are really for those large metropolitan areas where significant population growth and development is expected, because they really have the opportunity to do this. Next slide, please. And so just to summarize, because my wife sort of made fun of me for having three straight slides of tables and numbers. And so just to drive home the point, what those three slides were intended to convey is that there's two ways you can reduce VMT per capita. You can do it through land use policy and transportation policy, and hopefully you're doing it through a coordinated effort of both. But as a Tahoe region, relative to other regions, we are far more reliant on our transportation policy because we are so close to build out and because our maximum development is capped. So when you think about how we've formulated these proposals, we've really emphasized the implementation of the programs, policies, and projects of our RTP, because it is so fundamental to achieving the reductions that we're hoping to achieve through this target. Next slide, please. And actually, I'll just go right into the next slide after that. So the last bit of this is, we've established a target. How are we going to work towards that? And we've been calling that internally throughout this process our implementation framework, which is really just rebranding of adaptive management. We've established a plan. We're going to start to implement that plan. How do we make sure that we are checking our progress along the way and adjusting to make sure we're doing the right thing? Next slide, please. And so we started this by thinking about the current implementation framework, which many of you are probably aware of, which basically says if TRPA is not hitting its VMT threshold standard, we are not going to give out residential allocations for the year. So fundamentally, the construct behind that is, okay, we're not going to build 130 units, and that will somehow help us achieve our standard. And I think when we looked at the entire system and we think about what the interaction between land use and transportation policy, this wasn't driving us towards the outcome that we wanted. This is not a significant lever that once pulled, all of a sudden pulls our VMT back down and everything gets better. You don't build additional bike trails and you don't add any additional transit service by preventing a couple homes from being built. Next slide, please. So the way that we worked through this process is we thought about three things that we wanted to include. The first are a series of milestones. Because we're establishing a goal for ourselves for some time in the future, we want to make sure that we're checking our progress along the way to see that we're proceeding along the path and getting the gains that we think we're going to get. The second thing we wanted to emphasize was adaptive management responses. And so these are things that are automatically triggered if we start to fall off course. And the third was an advisory body. This is an independent panel that helps us assess the milestones and provides us with regular reporting on our progress, and probably most significantly, recommendations to improve and accelerate that progress. Next slide, please. So we established a series of milestones, and there's additional detail on all these in the staff report, but there are six milestones that I wanted to highlight for you. The first is one that Joanne started to talk about, and probably the one that needs the most explanation. So the first milestone is 2024, and that's the goal for having sustainable transportation funding in place. As I said before, and as Joanne mentioned, the key to achieving our goals is implementing the programs, policies, and projects within our RTP. And so we recognize the key to this threshold, the entire effort to achieving this new goal and reducing per capita VMT, is actually hinging upon getting that funding in place so that we can start to do all the cool things that we want around the region. So that's our first major milestone. And what we say is, if we don't hit that milestone, something will happen. Subsequent to that, we've established a series of milestones, roughly at 8-year intervals, to measure progress along the way towards achieving our goals. And they're at 8-year intervals because we think that's a reasonable time frame at which the mix between transportation and land use systems actually responds to meaningful change. We know that there are interannual variabilities because of weather or because of visitation or because of demographic trends that influence this on an annual basis. And we're really focusing on that longer term goal and working towards those progress, the working towards progress towards that longer term goal. You'll also notice an additional one here that's not evenly spaced in 8-year intervals like the other one in 2048. And the reason we've added that there is because that's the first year we expect to know if our target has been attained. So we're going to use a 3-year average interval to assess overall VMT per capita. So we'd expect to be in attainment in 2045, but because of some of the lags in monitoring and data collection, we'd expect to know about that in 2048. Next slide, please. So what happens if we don't hit any of those targets? What happens, let's say, if we don't get our a sustainable funding plan in place by 2045 or by 2024? Or what happens if we miss the VMT per capita reduction target in 2029? And what we've done is we've said there's two things that would just automatically happen if we fall off course. The first, for the funding one, is that we would increase the standard of significance for all projects to no unmitigated VMT, and that this would remain in place until a funding source was in place. Fairly simplistic, straightforward trigger. In 2029 and subsequent, if we start to fall off our VMT per capita milestones, what we've said is we'd increase the mobility mitigation fee rate by 10% over the previous year's value to start to close some of the funding gap and provide more funding for projects. Next slide, please. And lastly, so who is going to be the one compiling this information? Who's going to be making recommendations? And what we've suggested here is that we should have an independent advisory body that represents the jurisdictions, implementers, various stakeholders, that actually works through the evidence on a regular basis with us, checks how we're doing, evaluates which programs are working, where we're lagging, and then transmits recommendations for modifications to implementation of either our land use system or of our transportation system every 2 years. Next slide, please. So when you think about it, the entire system is really hinged on this overall approach that includes regular check-ins. So those are the blue boxes along the bottoms that summarize progress and where we formulate recommendations for change that we hope will help us continue to accelerate progress towards our goal. And then a series of discrete and specific milestones that must be met on the top there, that if they are not met, automatic change is automatically initiated. And so the bottom ones are the sort of adaptive management process. Those are the blue boxes. We're constantly reevaluating and optimizing things to ensure we're getting the returns that we expected. And then the orange boxes on the top are sort of the fallback to that that provides us with these triggered responses in the event that it's not, that other things are not working. Next slide, please. And now I'm going to hand it over to Melanie Sloan, who's going to talk a little bit about how we are updating our project impact assessment and mobility mitigation fee to ensure that future development within our region is consistent with the threshold standard and with this walkable, bikeable, transit-friendly future that we are trying to create for the region.
Thank you, Dan. Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Good. Excellent. Okay, so as Dan said, I'm going to walk us through the project impact assessment and mitigation fee update. And I want to take that moment, though it's been laid out really well by Joanne and by Dan previously, that link between the two efforts. This gets down to a very specific aspect of implementation of the VMT threshold, and that's at the project level. So updating our threshold standard policy and the objectives around that with greenhouse gas reduction and reduced reliance on the automobile and changing land use and development patterns, and that conversion to using a VMT per capita threshold requires us to also look at how we assess projects for transportation and air quality impacts and make sure that we're updating to align with that threshold as well as with our regional plan. Again, how are we implementing the VMT threshold at the project level? Next slide, please. And you saw this graphic with Dan. I stole it because it's a really good emphasis on discussing the differences between our current process and the framework as presented today and found in your packet. Under the current process, all projects are evaluated using average daily trips that the project generates. And it treats every project the same. So, excuse me, this process, just by using trips and being agnostic to the length of trips or the total vehicle miles traveled a project has on the transportation system through VMT, is disconnected from that VMT threshold outline. And that treating projects the same, regardless of where they're located, whether in a town center or regional center or in a more rural area, it also doesn't reflect alignment with that threshold or the regional plan and the goals of both. And as Dan described when he was talking to this graphic, and I'm trying to reflect again here, is that location of development does matter. Development that happens in or near a town center will have shorter trips, and even better, will have transportation options because there's transit service or there's sidewalks and bike paths to give users opportunities to go where they need and want in other ways than the personal automobile. Whereas development that's situated in more remote areas does not have those transportation options, or if they do, they're much more expensive to bring out to those remote areas. Next slide, please. And so returning back to the regional plan, you know, it is setting forth this vision for a more walkable, bikeable, and transit-served community, and doing so by improving land use and transportation solutions. So at TRPA, our policies advance that goal by providing incentives to move development into town centers and regional centers. And we have this opportunity because of our California jurisdictions also implementing vehicle miles traveled into project impact assessment from SB 743 to connect and align with that work and all of the research guidance and to improve our project impact assessment. And as a result, new development and redevelopment will help to accelerate achievement of that regional plan vision and the goals of the updated VMT threshold by reducing the 2-3% of additional VMT that we expect from development and redevelopment. And it's been said a couple of times before, and before getting into the framework, I want to remind everyone that this is a work in process. So the framework elements that I'll walk through today, as well as the framework presented and the packet, is the third iteration of thinking. It's been evolved through work with our partner, Placer County, and consultant Fair and Peers, input from the Transportation Technical Advisory Committee, as well as conversations with stakeholders, review of that guidance, as well as analysis conducted internally. And so this framework is a high-level outline of the project impact assessment and mitigation fee update. And I'm going to just walk through that outline before diving into a couple of the key components. First, a project applicant would compare its project information to screening criteria. And if it met that screening criteria, it would go to the uppermost process in this flowchart. It would not require additional assessment. Instead, it would calculate the fee and advance through the application process. However, if the project information did not meet that screening criteria, additional analysis would be required, and it would go through that middle and bottom portion. Additional analysis would depend on what type of project it is. With Fair and Peers and our partner Placer County, we'll be developing an online tool that the residential and tourist accommodation unit projects could use, and commercial, recreation, and other projects that aren't easily defined by our land use definitions would use a more detailed VMT analysis. And that might be the TRPA model or an agreed upon assessment such as a market study. Regardless of which approach the land use project would use for analysis or assessment, you'd see in both of those processes, it's really being evaluated to understand, does the VMT of the project have a significant impact to implementing the VMT threshold at the project level? And if it does, what does it need to do to mitigate, either through strategies or fees? Next slide, please. So let's talk about that current component, that first process in that flowchart, screening criteria. It's essentially a quick way to understand if a project should be expected to have a less than significant impact with VMT, and it can do so without requiring additional or detailed study. And And so our framework proposes two screening approaches, one based on project size, and the second based on the combination of project type and location. And attachment D in the packet provides the analysis for the screening criteria recommended for each of those two approaches and as presented in the packet itself. Next slide, please. The next component of the framework are standards of significance, and that's where you set that line to define above which a project would have a significant impact to transportation with its VMT. Here, the standard of significance applies to the net overall change in VMT. So what that would mean is new development would be producing new VMT, and so the standard would apply to that new VMT, whereas redevelopment that might be changing from a previous land use would be evaluated based on that net overall change in VMT. And the framework uses a sub-regional standard of significance by land use type. So what does that mean? That means, let's say we have a tourist accommodation unit project and it was going to be situated in Placer County. Now, it would be evaluated based on VMT per overnight visitor, and it would be evaluated on the against the current average VMT per overnight visitor in Placer County. And perhaps that same type of project is proposed in Douglas County. It would be compared to the Douglas County average VMT per overnight visitor. And what that sub-regional standard of significance does is it allows each jurisdiction to contribute to implementing the VMT threshold at the project level by reducing impacts of transportation by projects within their jurisdictions. The current thinking around the standards of significance for the framework can be found in Table 3 in Attachment B of your packet. And just some background, the way we came to those was in reference to current research, best practice, and guidance from California in relation to SB 743, but also receiving input from our partner Placer County and consultant Fair and Peers, input from the Transportation Technical Advisory Committee, and all of that was considered and adapted for Tahoe as necessary. Next slide. Also within the evaluation of the project to understand if it meets or, excuse me, if it has a significant impact is its mitigations. And so if a project is found to have that significant impact, it must mitigate to below that standard of significance and can do so either through strategies and or fees. So strategies would be available to the applicant in the online tool and discussed through a detailed VMT analysis if that was the approach used. And for an example, continuing that tourist accommodation unit, if I did not meet the screening criteria as the applicant for that project, it would go through that middle process, use the online project tool, and depending on project location and other information, maybe it's determined to have a significant impact. That tool lists various strategies, and I can select from one or more that would then calculate down calculate the impact to be less than significant. And those example strategies could be parking pricing at the tourist accommodation unit or providing a shuttle or van pool for staff. And then fees would also be determined. And those fees will be set. It will be updating our air quality mitigation fee to more of a mobility mitigation fee. It will be determined using rough proportionality and nexus and calculated using the RTP constrained project list and VMT calculated projected from new development and redevelopment. The framework proposes those fees vary by location, and that it would depend on whether the project was located in a low or high VMT generating area. And again, that is that recognizing that projects in more remote areas would pay more mitigation fees because it costs more and there would be more VMT to mitigate. Next slide. And so returning to the framework and to walk through perhaps a couple of projects. Before doing that though, I just want to distill this whole framework approach into a very simple statement. And that is essentially, if a project is proposed in or within half mile of a town center or regional center and meets screening criteria, it will have a very simplified assessment process. But if it's in a more remote location or does not meet the screening criteria, additional analysis will be required and potentially higher fees as well. And that whole framework is to incentivize that development and redevelopment into town and regional centers through incentives, here being simplified assessment and lower fees. So quickly, let's talk about a couple of projects. I'll continue my tourist accommodation unit. Let's say I want to add 15 units to an existing hotel, and it happens to be within a half mile of a town center. Great, I meet the screening criteria of project type and location, and so I'd go through the uppermost process here in this flow chart. No additional assessment would be required, and my fee would be calculated and I'd advance through the application process. But what if I didn't choose as ideal a location, and I'm not within or in a town center, within a half mile or in a town center or regional center? I then would not meet that screening criteria, and so I'd have to do additional analysis, and I would go through the middle process on this flow chart using the online tool. Depending on the information I add and the general location of the project, the tool would calculate whether I have a significant impact. And let's say I did, I would choose from those suite of strategies, those mitigation strategies, like I said on the last slide, maybe I choose parking pricing. And the tool calculates that's sufficient to have my project have a less than significant impact. The fee is calculated, I advance through the application process. Another project type, perhaps I'm proposing 15,000 square feet of commercial floor area. That doesn't meet either the project small project screen or the project type and location screen. And so I would automatically know I needed to do additional analysis. Because it's a commercial project, I would have to go through the bottommost process in this flow chart, doing a detailed VMT analysis, where again, the project's VMT is evaluated based on the components of the project and its general location, and determination of whether it has a significant impact or not. Mitigations, whether they be strategies and or fees, would be identified as applicable. Next slide, please. And so returning to this being a work in process, I walked through the framework at a fairly high level. There are a lot of components that we have proposed in the packet and will continue to develop with partners, including Placer County, and in consultation with stakeholders and other jurisdictions. And once we have those, and part of the development of those components is creating maps for those general location assessments of VMT and fees. And that would also have us finalizing the mitigation fee framework. Once all those components are in place, we would then take a few land use cases, kind of like what I did in this last slide, but at a more detailed level, through the final framework. And we do that to make sure it operates the way we expect, but also to be able to revise it as needed based on any of the findings of those tests. Concurrently, we'll develop the online tool with Fair and Peers and Placer County. And I just want to say there's quite a lot of work that goes into this, but that's because we are looking to have a reliable, predictable, and transparent process for applicants and others in the community interested in this facet of VMT threshold implementation at the project level. And with that, I thank you for your attention throughout all of our presentations. And next slide can move to Q&A.
Okay, well, thank you very much, all of you, for a thorough presentation of, and especially the overview and also some of the details. So, committee members, do you have any comments or questions about what you've heard and also the material that was included in our packet?
Bill, I have a quick question for Melanie.
Sure.
Melanie, in connection with the mitigation fee framework, obviously, based on the example that you provided, there's kind of a higher bar for commercial projects because the assumption is that they will result in an increase in VMT. But what if that commercial project is part of a mixed-use development where essential services are being provided on site? I'm assuming that would be one of those kind of unique circumstances that would be given, you know, due consideration and might not be required to go through a more extensive analysis?
That's an excellent question. And one, our project team with Placer County and Fair and Peers have been discussing a mixed-use project that may have perhaps tourist accommodation and commercial combined, how that would be treated. So I don't have a definitive answer. It's something we are talking about, and it's one of those components that we'll continue to develop before bringing back the framework to you. Any thoughts or input from you or other members of the committee and public on that are appreciated.
Okay, thank you, Melanie.
Mr. Chair, this is John Frederick. I have a question.
Sure, John, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Melanie and Dan. Great presentations. I love the elephant, Dan. So my question is related to the absolute VMT numbers and the assumptions that go into that denominator of total travelers. And just, I guess the question is, how are you proposing to monitor that shift? For example, we've seen a huge day visitation in the last year under the pandemic. It's not hard to imagine. Under various climate scenarios, we get increased visitation for more scarce snow events like we're having right now in the future, or people escaping heat from the valley. Or, you know, we've seen a growth in the local population as folks are doing remote work. So a whole variety of variables that could be different than the assumptions that underlie that denominator. So what is the plan to kind of evaluate and monitor and respond to the actual visitation numbers? Because, I mean, if we get a 6.8% reduction in per capita VMT, but a 30% increase beyond, you know, what was forecast in total visitation, for example, that would swamp the more efficient per capita number. So just questions on that set of things as it relates to total VMT in this new model, this new approach.
Yeah, thanks. So we presented a couple different ideas. I'll take the total VMT first and then go into the per capita number. So the total VMT, we've historically used our travel demand model to evaluate. And I think we foresee that continuing to be a tool to evaluate the overall effectiveness of different strategies to reduce VMT. What we've suggested here is that for the threshold standard itself, we should use the state reporting. So both states, as part of the Federal Highway Administration, report the total number of VMT or the total amount of VMT traveled within the region on an average day. And so we're proposing to combine those two estimates to provide the estimate for the region. We've explored a number of big data sources for providing that, probably most notably one called Streetlight data for estimation. And I think the conclusion we came to at the behest, I think, of the technical advisory committee that we were consulting is that those may not be ripe for interannual comparison just yet because of the methodological differences in how you estimate VMT in a given year. So deferring to the more stable sources of state and federal data would be the best way to handle that. What we're proposing to do on the per capita number is actually a project that's been supported by a group with the Tahoe Science Advisory Council, some researchers from the University of Nevada, Reno, and University of California at Davis. And the reason is because the total number of people within our region, while it may seem obvious at a given time, is not a number that we readily have at our hands, or really that any jurisdiction does. And I think, you know, what we've heard is that is an incredibly important number to know for these planning purposes. So we've spent about the past 6 months with them developing a protocol to estimate that that uses a bottom-up approach. So we're actually using the traffic counts at our entry-exit stations to monitor the flow or the number of cars into the region. We're using information on hotel, motel occupancy, VHR occupancy, to identify and map the number of visitors within the region at any given time. And then what we know from surveys on travel patterns of individual visitor types to help parameterize and arrive at the overall estimate of the number of people. So that number will also be dynamic as we move forward and responsive to all those things that you outline and that drive visitation or drive the population dynamics within the region.
So there will also be tools then to use the adaptive management process for the absolute VMT numbers in addition to the per capita. I mean, if the assumptions prove to underestimate actual visitation, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years out.
Sure. Yep. And I think, you know, that's the intention actually of that advisory body that's providing recommendations to sort of look at the underlying assumptions, look at the data, and then provide us with management recommendations for how we can improve and better tailor our programs to address the drivers of VMT that we're seeing.
I guess just the other question is the consideration being given to peak visitation? And again, my scenario in climate change futures where you have infrequent snowstorms and a huge rush of people throughout California to come sled in a smaller number of storms, or intense heat in the summer and there's a big crush of people to escape heat in those scenarios. I mean, how is that accommodated in the planning? Peak demand.
So it's interesting that you mentioned climate change and peak demand, because the second part of our project with the Science Advisory Council is actually looking at how really hot days down in the valleys, how that influences transportation travel within the Tahoe region, and trying to formulate methods primarily driven by big data to allow us to better understand where people are coming from, where they're going to, and how they're traveling around the region on those days, in part to prepare exactly for what you're talking about. We expect to have more of those days in the future, and we want to be able to provide transportation planners with the information they need to actually tailor solutions specifically to the future environment and visitation patterns of the region.
Right, and just final question / comment on that line would be, it's not hard to imagine that you have the peak visitation increasingly at the same time we have extremely high fire risk in the basin, and that's not a good combination, right? So even if we have a more efficient per capita VMT, but we have a big surge in the number of vehicles in the basin at the very time, July and August, when we have extremely high fire danger, it's just, you know, it would be something I would want to put out there to plan for, so.
No, I think that's right. And I think the evacuation planning is something that's ongoing in other venues.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Jim Lawrence, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. Great presentation. Absolutely fantastic, Dan, Melanie, and Joanne. I would have not... At the beginning, I thought it was going to be painful to sit here for an hour on VMT, and I was actually absolutely riveted. So, excellent job. And if my camera was on, you'd see that I'm giddy with excitement. So, just a tremendous, great work by staff, by the advisory committee, Placer County, Fair and Piers, the whole crew. You know, I get that the devil's going to be in the details. And so, you know, as you know, if this does move forward, which I'm in that camp, be taking a close look at how the details and the implementation are. But to take an antiquated VMT threshold that we've been reviewing against that really doesn't mean anything, and actually move it forward to tie to our regional transportation plans and our goals with the regional plan update with the two states, particularly in Nevada, to align it with greenhouse gas emission reduction, as well as mobility and reduced dependence on the automobile. I'm just excited. And I think, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is the right direction to go. I really appreciated, Melanie, the project examples that really helped me understand how this was going to work. I'm really excited about having an online tool for individuals as they're planning their projects. We've done similar work in Nevada, not in VMT, but with endangered species work at rural Nevada, and industry has responded very positively to having that online tool because it really helps with the planning of the projects. So, as far as I'm concerned, you know, my comment is really just to commend the work of the group. I like the direction. I do understand the devil's going to be in the details, and certainly have a close eye towards that as this gets further refined. I do have one basic question. It's just really just to clarify for myself. I've heard conversations of an air quality fee. I've heard conversations of a VMT fee. I've heard a mobility fee. My assumption is that the air quality mitigation fee is being updated to include or account for VMT and mobility, and that there's still one fee and not multiple fees. But I might be wrong, but I just need that clarity.
No, you're absolutely correct, Jim, and thank you for pointing that out and clarifying for me. I apologize for not doing that in the presentation. So currently, project impact assessment includes an air quality mitigation fee. That's based on trips. We, in updating the mitigation fee program, will be updating that to align with the project impact assessment and the VMT threshold, using VMT as the calculating factor, and with the aim of the same goals of greenhouse gas reduction and reduced reliance on the automobile. So we've started reframing the air quality mitigation fee as a mobility mitigation fee. So you may have heard both and wondered, are they one and the same? And they exactly are. They are the same.
Thank you, Melanie. That's what I assumed, but I didn't want to make an assumption. So I appreciate that clarification. And then lastly, to follow up on John's points, and I think they're, to me, the adaptive management is going to be key, because particularly in the transportation space, it seems like it's evolving so much year to year that an adaptive management component is going to be critical. Particularly with, you know, we don't know what visitation, you know, how much increased visitation is going to go up or down, maybe, you know, as the years go. So that's going to be critical. But I am hoping, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if this were to be successful and we were starting to get our RTP projects implemented, particularly around sustainable recreation, that perhaps a 10% increase in visitation once we get those systems in place won't be as impactful as a 10% increase in visitation prior to getting those projects in place. Like if we have a 10% increase in 2021, with no corridor implementations and no shuttles in place, that's probably a more dramatic impact to the transportation system than a 10% visitor increase when we do have those things in place. And that's kind of how I'm thinking, but I think that's all has to be weaved into sort of that adaptive management component. And again, thank you all for the presentation. I thought it was great.
Hey, Bill.
Thank you, Jim. Mark.
Hi. That's Mark
Bruce. This is Barbara Jaffe. I'm on.
Oh, hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. Great. How are you guys doing?
We're still in our committee hearing.
Okay, so just I'll hang on, or do you want me to call back?
Well, if you hang on, I think we're probably, we're probably 30 minutes, at least 30 minutes away to the governing board meeting, simply because we'll probably take a break after this.
Okay, then I'll call back.
Okay, thanks, Barbara.
Hi.
Hey, Bill.
Mark, you had a comment?
Yes, please.
Sure, go ahead.
Thanks. So I too thought that was a wonderful presentation. You've taken something that can be viewed in a very complicated, very difficult to understand way, and you've made it very understandable, and you've made it very positive. And I have been watching this progress through the stages, and I feel really, really good about where we are. So I just wanted to thank you very much for all your hard work and making it so understandable and positive for us and for the community. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Any other comments from my colleagues on the committee before I open up to public comment?
Mr. Chair, this is Cindy.
Yeah, Cindy.
Thank you. I too, Dan and Melanie and Joanne, want to echo the compliments on the presentation. It was very thorough, and for such a confusing issue to so many of us, I think it really simplified it down to a very good understanding of how to tackle this issue. I really appreciated all the examples, Melanie, and the one thought I continue to raise and will continue to raise is that I want to create an environment where the jurisdictions have an opportunity to propose a set of projects on a more jurisdictional basis to be evaluated, so that that we're building a system. In other words, project by project, 15 units here, 20 units there. Yes, we can require, we can collect fees, but if we can get real commitment from the jurisdictions, and I know with Placer County and moving forward with hopefully a T-bid, we're going to have significant dollars that we can work toward those kind of more regional projects. And so I just want to make sure that we can evaluate those through this screening criteria and kind of by capacity to incentivize our town center reinvestments. Because when we go project by project, it becomes quite an obstacle for those individuals to reinvest and see the type of redevelopment we want. So want to continue to encourage that thinking as we move through the process and think about those examples where a town center could actually invest in a system and fund that system, and through that, have capacity for a certain number of new investment units, whether it's mixed use or tourist accommodation or commercial.
Thank you, Cindy, for sharing that. I'll bring that back to the team as we continue to work on the framework.
Thank you.
Okay. I think everybody's had a chance to talk about the presentation, ask questions and comments. I don't want to cut anybody off, but I'm about ready to head into public comment. So Catherine, if you'd open up the opportunity for public comment on this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any member of the public wishes to make a public comment on this item, you can use the hand raising feature in GoToWebinar, which is on the left-hand side of your control panel. We do have a few hands up at this moment. So Carol Black, you're unmuted on my end, and you can go ahead and address the committee.
Good morning. I guess it's almost afternoon at this point, but thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I want to echo the committee, your comments. The overall framework of this presentation was phenomenal, and I would suggest, although maybe it exists elsewhere and I just am not aware, that some of the framing concepts that Joanne Marpetta made at the beginning are incredibly useful. And if there's some way to make graphics to present how all these pieces fit together, it would be really helpful to the casual user like me. As you know, I'm a resident of Incline Village, and I'm very interested in this and also interested in thinking about the metrics. So that was one comment. The other comment I had is, please don't lose the overall total VMT number as a measure that kind of impacts, looks at occupancy, some elements of over-tourism, et cetera. So I understand all the arguments that were made, and I think they all make good sense, but I would really hope that we also continue to look at the overall measurement as a measure just of overall volumes of use. Also suggest that we not lose focus on kind of collateral impacts, and in addition to sustainable communities, sustainable tourism. There's discussion about land use and transportation, that balance, and I get it. I think it's right on the money, but I will say one thing, that the focus on land use and development and maybe redevelopment credits, which you guys focus on a lot, is important. But think about vacation rentals, short-term rentals, and whether those are actually really looked at with those measurements as you think forward. I also think about the collateral impacts and interacting pieces. So there's transit, there's occupancy of the area, what's safe, transportation, evacuation capability, parking and traffic safety. And as you think about transport and town center, think about all those pieces fitting together. And I'm not sure we always get all the collateral impacts. Bottom line is we want to improve, but in my mind, we also want to do no harm. And some of it may have to do with how we put together these various pieces and also the order in which they are implemented. And I'm going to go to the East Lake Tahoe Trail just for one comment. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But boy, it would have sure been great from the incline perspective. Parking could have been dealt with ahead of time. And so that's just an example of timing and thinking through all the collateral impacts. I'm not trying to minimize all the effort that went into that. It's a wonderful project, but there are some adverse impacts. So thank you very much and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Carol. Next, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next up, Sophie Wenslow. You're unmuted on my end to address the committee.
Good morning, everyone. This is Sophie Wenslow commenting on behalf of the California Attorney General's Office. I also want to express appreciation for staff's very thorough presentation today on this complex and nuanced topic. As you know, our office is carefully following PRPA's handling of this critically important issue. We have participated in a stakeholder working group related to updating the VMT threshold since last summer, and have engaged with and commented on issues related to updating the threshold since at least 2017. We submitted a comment letter last night expressing concerns both with TRPA's engagement with our office and with the substantive proposal, and encourage ARPIC to take a close look at our letter. As explained in that letter, staff did not share its updated VMT threshold materials with stakeholders until the close of business last Wednesday. This gave stakeholders 4 business days to review, analyze, and respond to the 200 plus pages of material in advance of this meeting. That is not enough time for our office to carefully review and comment on such a significant proposal. As a committed partner that has participated in good faith in the stakeholder process since last summer, we would have appreciated the opportunity to share what we expect would have been helpful comments with ARPIC at this meeting. In the future, when stakeholders have invested such significant time and resources in a collaborative process with staff, we hope staff will provide all involved stakeholders with more time to review and comment on updated materials in advance of ARPIC and governing board meetings, particularly where recommendations or direction are being requested. At a high level, we express continued concern about TRPA's proposal to decouple the BMT threshold from its traditional late clarity protection function. We are also concerned about staff's proposal to link the VMT threshold to the draft 2020 RTP SCS, particularly since that plan has not yet been finalized or approved. Joanne mentioned earlier that TRPA expects the RTP SCS to hold total basin-wide VMT to near zero growth between now and 2045. However, our review indicates that both total VMT and per capita VMT could be much higher than TRPA anticipates under the RTP SCS. As Jim said, the devil is in the details. We encourage ARPIC to take a close look at our letter, which touches on this concern and our other high-level substantive concerns. Our office is diligently working on a more detailed comment letter, which we will share as soon as we can. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I understand your concern about all the material that was presented. A lot of this material was covered in the TTAC discussions, I think we've reached out a lot to the Attorney General's office, and we've benefited greatly on many of the projects we've worked together on comments and concerns that made the process better. And I think that's the way we're going to proceed at this point forward. There are some details we need to work out, no question about it. But I hope that I'm sure staff's going to be working closely with the California Attorney General staff and others on getting this together. We understand there might be some differences about why you want to hang on to an outdated VMT thing from my standpoint, but certainly interested in what it is that you expect us to gain from that when we don't really have a nitrate problem. And there are other ways that it's being dealt with, but we do have a serious transportation problem. I'm certainly committed to continue working with the California Attorney General staff, and I'm sure the staff is too. But I appreciate your comments and frustration with the timing, but it's been difficult putting all these things together, and today is just kind of like one of those typical days in the virtual world of trying to put all this together. But we definitely want to include a good working relationship with the California Attorney General's office. So thank you for your comments.
Peter Kratz, you're unmuted on my end to address the committee.
Thank you so much. Hi, everyone. RPIC. I am Peter Kratz. I'm with Placer County Public Works Department. And if I can make a few comments on this item. I was a longtime employee for Placer County. I strongly recommend that the RPIC support the proposed VMT threshold as presented by TRPA staff today. As mentioned by Melanie, especially Placer County has worked very closely with TRPA staff on supporting a reasonable and balanced VMT threshold solution for the basin. 4 points I'd like to make on why would include the following. Number one, when Joanne opened up this presentation, one of the most salient points she made was the number 3% 3% VMT increase attributed to future development in the basin. So I look at that, and being working in the basin for a long time for Placer County, what I hear and see is that folks need to stop focusing on development being the main culprit to increasing VMT. And conversely, number two, as pointed out by Dan and Melanie in their presentations, development projects will ultimately help decrease VMT per capita in the basin through project level mitigation and contribute to system-wide solutions like fully connected, frequent, and convenient public transit and microtransit systems. Wouldn't that be great? Number three, consistency with nearby VMT threshold adoptions. VMT is a regional issue, as we know. It's not a basin-only issue. Considering a total or absolute VMT cap or limit is inconsistent with nearby jurisdictions, including Placer County, where we've adopted a per capita threshold on outside the basin recently. The other 57 counties in California and 300 cities in California, along with Caltrans, going down the same path of a per capita threshold approach. An absolute VMT limit approach will lead to an inconsistent, convoluted approach, delaying efforts with delivering VMT reducing improvements in the. And I do agree with the previous comment that the VMT cap still is there as a tool, as Dan pointed out in his presentation. I think it's pertinent, and it's very important to track everything going on in and out of the basin with VMT. So it remains a tool, but it shouldn't be the main metric going forward for consistency. And number four, finally, we have talked and studied VMT to death in the basin. And just like Dan and Melanie and Joanne presented today, they've put their heart and soul into this as one of the top issues in the basin for really sustaining the environment. I think they've come up with a great framework. Sure, the devil is definitely in the details. There's still things to hammer out along the way, but I truly applaud and support the approach that they've made working with our staff in Placer County and how it can be adopted in the other local jurisdictions going forward. So it's time to move forward with this proposal. And again, there's always time to work out the details along the way so we can keep things moving forward in a positive way. Thank you for allowing me to make comments.
Well, thank you, Peter, for making comment. And also, it's always a pleasure working with you in Placer County on these issues. Thank you. Kathy?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make public comment on this item.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'll bring it back to the committee. I did see a letter from the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and they also had some of the devil in the detail questions that I think should get worked out. I kind of appreciated some of their comments, and another key member of the TTAC committee that I know staff will be working with. Not to belabor this anymore, guys, because I've already run over my time on this committee, but maybe if someone wants to think about making the proposed motion that's at page 577 of our packet regarding the direction we'd like to send staff and continuing with this effort. I think you can see they've done a lot of work, and they're doing the connection between our regional transportation plan, a sustainable community strategy, our regional plan, and this VMT threshold is the future. It's where we have to be to address the transportation problems we have, and the work that we're doing in the bi-state and now in the work plan that you'll hear this afternoon at the EIP Transportation Committee, where we're really going to have to get the basin on board to say how we want to pay for and manage and operate a transit transportation system that'll include many, many different pieces. We're going to make the pitch elsewhere that we need the money. We need funding to carry this out. It's critical. So anybody want to make the motion? I'm through making my pitch.
Sure, Bill.
Mr. Chairman.
I'll make a motion directing staff to finalize development of the per capita VMT standard, implementing goals and policies, and the revisions to the project impact assessment and air quality mitigation fee as discussed in this staff report.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions about the recommendation from the committee? Okay, well, Tracy, would you just do a quick roll call?
Ms. Aldean?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, okay. The motion passes.
Thank you very much, Tracy. And thank you, members. I think that's staff will keep working on this, and we'll get this done. I know we will. So the next item is any committee member comments. I do thank John for attending, and look forward to his participation in the future committee meetings on this issue and other issues. And appreciate your comments also, John, from a perspective of someone in your position as a city council member and dealing with sometimes those hot days in the valley where we all come to Tahoe for a little bit of relief.
Right.
So, Catherine, I guess this is for the final public interest comment period on the committee. Are there any hands out there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If any members of the public would like to make a comment to the Regional Plan Implementation Committee, please use the hand raising button on the left hand side of your control panel. Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to make a general public comment.
Thank you, Catherine. Well, then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bruce, would you want to say about when you think we're almost at noon? What time would you like to start up the governing board meeting?
I think maybe 12:15. Is that okay, Joanne?
That sounds fine, Mr.
Bruce. Or do you want to do 12:10?
No. I think I would recommend that we give members a break at this point. It's a time to grab a quick bite to eat. We will not take a separate lunch break today. So I'd recommend giving, a good 15 minutes to folks.
Great. Thank you. So 12:15. And Bill, thank you so much for your leadership on that meeting, especially the VMT. And Joanne, and your points as well. Thanks so much. Talk to you guys in 12:15.
Okay, 12:15. So a motion to adjourn the committee, please.
So moved.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for a very good, lengthy, but very, very good committee meeting. Thank you very much.